high atop the skyline of downtown Chicago to 38 states and Canada. Your host for this evening, Justin Kaufman.
Good evening and welcome. 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman with you tonight. It's 11 o'clock. This chilly February evening. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Diane Ravitch is here. She's the author of Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. If you're familiar, Diane Ravitch has had quite an illustrious career when it comes to education. She was an educator, and her big claim to fame is she was the Undersecretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Give you an idea of where she's at. She has been on the forefront of trying to protect public schools against privatization, charter schools, and some of the other ills, and to really defend what was once considered the gem of this country. There's been so much talk about universal health care, right? We've heard a million different ways this has been bounced around in a campaign year. And for many people who are opponents of health care, one of the things they'll say is that's not the government's job. That's socialism. This is not what we should be doing with taxpayer money. But Diane Ravitch points out in her book that public education started back in the early 19th century. And that is a form of universal public education. Before that, only rich people got educated. So it's one of the longer standing, I guess you'd say, socialist programs in this country. But as she points out in her book, in 2020, it's getting closer and closer to being dismantled. We'll talk about the future of public education, standardized tests, all that stuff with Diane Ravitch coming up at 8 o'clock. Very excited about that. Heather Sharon will be here from the Daily Line. We've got lots to talk about, including the mayor of Chicago's new plan for affordable housing around the Jackson Park area and the Obama Presidential Center. This is a huge issue. People campaigned on it, and Mayor Lightfoot campaigned on it. What happens when the Obama Presidential Center takes up parts of Jackson Park and those surrounding areas, include Woodlawn and South Shore, some of the South Side neighborhoods, become gentrified? Because everybody wants to live next to the best presidential center in the history of presidential centers. What happens to the people that were living there before? The mayor says she has a plan to protect affordable housing. The aldermen of the area say it's not enough. It's a good negotiation start, but it's not enough. Heather Sharon has been covering this story. This is a real make or break moment for the Obama Presidential Center. Because they've been asking for a community benefits agreement, and we see this a lot with housing or stadiums in different cities. When they build a stadium, maybe in a blighted neighborhood, there's a community benefits agreement to say that that there's some protections for the community so it doesn't get gentrified and condos go up and the poor people go out, which would be an ironic situation for the Obama Presidential Center since he spent so much time as an organizer helping the poor on the south side of Chicago, and his center comes in and kicks them out. That's what the communities are worried about, rightfully so. But the mayor has put forth a plan. We'll talk to Heather Sharon about it coming up. And also, I got to ask Heather, what's taking so long on Mayor Lightfoot's endorsement for the presidential primary? Seems like she's kind of a big player. If you listen to Rahm Emanuel, mayors run the world now. Where is the endorsement? Who is Mayor Lightfoot putting her clout and power behind? We'll talk about that coming up at 7:30. This weekend's going to have a huge conflux of television watching. You're going to have the South Carolina primaries, and you're going to have quite possibly the most popular program on television right now, RuPaul's Drag Race. Season 12 kicks off on Friday. South Carolina primaries on Saturday. A group in Chicago called Drag Them to the Polls are bringing the two together to get the gay community motivated for the upcoming election and primary day. Drag queens and the drag community are getting out the vote. Drag Them to the Polls will be a show on Friday night to celebrate drag culture, watch RuPaul, and talk politics. We'll have some of the performers in studio tonight. And coming up at 10 o'clock, and this is hard for me to say, But tonight, 10 o'clock, as you know, on Wednesday nights, we have the swap meet. This is the great segment that we do where we will evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, stuff in the that you got in the attic, some stuff you might have in the trash to see if it's worth something. Greg Flamm, a listener to WGN Radio who's also a picker, has come on the program for 4 years. Tonight will be his last of the swap meet. Greg is moving. Got a call, a terrible call, last week where Greg said that he is, as of March 1st, moving out of state. And this will be the last swap meet tonight on the program. And that's hard. I went through the years. We started this in May of 2016. 4 years of doing this program. Right? Once a week. There was a little moment where we stopped when we moved to the morning, but he came with us. And it's been great because it's widely accepted by you, the WGN listener. We say it's swap meet time. The lines light up. Everybody's got something to share. So tonight we'll do our final swap meet performance with Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker coming up at 10 o'clock. I can't even believe it. Such a good bit. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. The lines are open all night. Text line as well. I'm looking forward to talking to you tonight. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN. Stay with us. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Mary says, no, I've been listening to Greg since he first came on with you, Justin. I can't believe how sad this makes me. He's such a good personality. He was great on the radio. Tell Greg how much I enjoyed him. I wish him the best. Well, you can tell him. He's coming up at 10 o'clock. Yeah. 630 says, what time is Greg on? Greg will be on at 10 o'clock, if you did not hear Greg Flamm and the swap meet, the final swap meet tonight at 10 o'clock. Greg is moving out of state, and we are having our final swap meet tonight, 10 o'clock. Hmm. 312-981-7200. I saw a great text. Oh, here it is, 217. How about RuPaul debating Donald Trump? That could be done at the Petrillo Music Show. Raise money for charity. Talking about RuPaul's drag race and politics, which will be celebrated this weekend up in Andersonville. The big stories tonight, the two big stories are, one is, of course, of concern. The other is just terrible. And one of the worst shootings in Wisconsin history, 6 people killed, including the gunman, during a shooting rampage this afternoon at Molson Coors in the Miller Valley complex in Milwaukee. It's a terrible story, and it reminds Chicagoans of what happened in Aurora just over a year ago. It's one of those stories that becomes less about let's take calls and talk about guns, or let's talk about safety in the workplace, and just more about heartbreak, because this is a story that is as old as time, where someone is disgruntled because they're let go from a job, and they come back angry with rage and take it out on their employers and their coworkers. The president spoke to the country this evening about the coronavirus and concerns about whether or not the administration was handling it. It seems like he has appointed the vice president to be point on the task force, or at least the White House's reaction to the oncoming virus or pandemic that the Center for Disease Control has warned us about. He had a great lineup of talented, brilliant scientists behind him. But the big story, as that was happening, the first coronavirus case with, quote, unknown origins was announced while he was speaking on stage. It was announced in Northern California. This, of course, what the United States, the CDC, was expecting. So this could be the start. It also might be why the White House was speaking about it tonight. But that's the fear, that the coronavirus will come here not from somebody who's traveling from China, but to find its way through unknown origins and be part of a start of a pandemic. Are you worried? 312-981-7200. This program, watching the president tonight, watched it in the office, it reminded me of a lot of the conversations we've had on this program, evening after evening, when the virus was first discovered and the outbreak began in Wuhan, China, about whether or not you're concerned, whether or not you're going to change your habits, your routines, whether or not you'll travel. After tonight, watching the president talk about it and getting more information from the CDC, have you changed your mind? 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Let me know. It's amazing, too, because it is changing habits and routines. A good example is Ash Wednesday. The Philippines are not religious leaders, Catholic priests in the Philippines. They're not administering ashes on foreheads today for Ash Wednesday. Instead, because of the coronavirus, they're sprinkling ashes on people's heads. That's how concerned they are about touch. The priest is just like, here, sprinkle. Just sprinkle some ash on top of your head. Which, I don't know if that counts. I feel like that's kind of a cop-out. What I would do, and I'm not a religious person, I'm not a priest, but I would get a long stick, put some ashes on the end of the stick, still get the cross on the head. Right? Or maybe robots. Robot priests? But I feel like it's a cop-out to sprinkle on the top. My favorite story so far to come out about the coronavirus is the CDC's recommendations for shaving your facial hair. There's a concern that some beards, mustaches, they will interfere with the face pieces, the respirators. They'll also, because you can catch more germs in your beard, could cause you trouble. So they have suggested, and this is what the CDC suggested today, that there are some forms of facial hair that are acceptable, and there are some that are not. So, on the list for acceptable, side whiskers, soul patches, lampshades, I'm not sure what lampshades are, and handlebar mustaches. Those are good to go. But the beard, the stubble, the mutton chops, if you're wearing a mutton chop, they're not recommended. So the coronavirus may actually change your routines in the sense that it may change your look, your style. All right, let's go to Bill. Bill, are you concerned about the coronavirus?
Oh, absolutely. My wife and I have a cruise planned for June.
Okay.
It's just in England and Canada cruise. But with what's going on, it's just really the unknown has you really concerned.
Yeah. The one thing I would say, Bill, about that is just that the president has said this and scientists have said it as well. I know there's the ridicule on Twitter and whatever, but viruses like the flu or the coronavirus, when it gets to warmer months, it starts to dissipate. So there's still hope and optimism that this is a clustered event, that the outbreak is a winter event. And we've heard from many scientists that this could be a recurring virus, meaning it could be something that actually comes back every October, November, December, in the winter months. So for those like Bill who are concerned about getting on a cruise, maybe in the summertime, the anxiety is real, I understand it, but at the same time, there's a lot of time to transpire. But at the same time, there's many people who are concerned about flying or going to other countries. I, spring break is coming up. Spring break is, in a month plus. And we're going to, as I mentioned last week, we're going to the ABC Islands. Not necessarily an area, but today, South America became the last populated region of the planet to have coronavirus cases. The only place that's left is the Antarctic. There have been no reported cases. I want to make this clear. Reported. It could be a bunch of penguins down there with coronavirus. They're just not telling anybody. But the only place on the planet right now is the Antarctic. Everywhere else has had, or by continent, has had coronavirus. And the question just becomes, as we've talked about as well, what are the ways you can protect yourself? And one of the ways you can is just to follow the same protocol that you would for the flu. Wash your hands. Everything's solved by washing your hands. You can go to all the hepatitises the world down to the viruses. Just wash your hands. Maybe that'll be just our future. Every time we take five steps, there'll be a sink for us to wash our hands. We'll become a germaphobe society where all we do is wash hands. If you don't wash your hands every 2.5 minutes, you get buzzed. You have to wear a buzzer from the CDC, and if you don't wash your hands, it's like a clock. It's like the show 24. You know, remember, deek, 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 deek. If it hits that number, you get a little buzz, a little shock to the chest. Oh, and then you got to wash your hands. I think that's all we can do. 773 says, nutrition can block virus better than medicine. Lysol kills the viruses. All the same kind of stuff that we've been hearing about. 773 says, I'm not worried, but the breakout of all viruses worry me. Therefore, I take precaution. There you go. Aaron Moore. Aaron says that the Hitler mustache, the little guy right there, that's compatible. That's acceptable by the CDC. So we're all going to be walking around with that little mustache. That's awful. What am I going to do here, Pete? I've got a nice, fluffy, healthy beard. I'm going to have to go to more like a disco look. I'm going to get a soul patch like I'm in the band Vertical Horizon. I don't want to do that. That's the CDC's approach. It wasn't really about specific hairstyles or facial hairstyles. It was just saying, you got to look like you're in the 90s. You can only have facial hair that looks like it's anywhere between 1993 and 1998. Anything in there is good. Anything after that, you're screwed. 773 says, viruses are more easily in the winter because people are in closer proximity to each other. True. Nailed it. Except for guys like me, in the summertime, I just like, even though it's hot out, I like to be real close to people. I'm real close. I like to rub my shoulder sweat on your shoulder sweat. What can I say? I'm an outsider. I break the norms. But it sounds to me that I know there's been a lot of ridicule and there's been a lot of concern and worry about the administration's reaction to the coronavirus. But today, I thought that fears were eased in the sense that the administration and the people who spoke on that podium seemed to have an understanding of what they were dealing with. I won't go as far. I know what happens is we take the information from the White House, from whatever the president tweets or what he says getting on a chopper or something like that. And sometimes that's not necessary. That's what gets us a little bit anxious because he says things like, oh, it'll go away, as he's jumping on an airplane or tweets, it'll go away. And it scares people that no one's really thinking about it. And I'm glad that today they had the foresight to put some of the experts that they have brought together for Health and Human Services and beyond, people who do this kind of work and deal with viruses, bring them in and let them talk and explain what this country is doing to try and protect its citizens. I thought that was good. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here, and then Heather Sharon will join us. We'll talk a little bit about some local stories, including why the mayor of Chicago has yet to endorse anybody in the Democratic primary. Also, we can talk to her about coronavirus fears here in Chicago and affordable housing. Will that be the stickler when it comes to the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park? Those conversations coming up right after the news with Heather Sharon here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, let's keep going on coronavirus. Heather Sharon's going to join us in just a minute. Ron, what's your thought on coronavirus and what you heard from the president today?
Well, you know what? I was over there 3 weeks. I just got back about
really?
3 weeks ago. I was over in Shenzhen, which is probably the distance between Chicago and, say, St. Paul from where Wahoon was, where the breakout was. And we were there when it was all starting to come down. It was kind of cool because I kind of like excitement. And we went home that night and watched Contagion just to kind of get updated and know what we had to do. Bottom line is I think I was trying to get some information, some news information. All we got was closed circuit television over there. The news here is so over-sensationalized about it. I mean, I got back to work to go to work, and they kept me out of work for 2 weeks, quarantine.
Hmm.
And my doctor wouldn't even see me because I had to get a letter from the Department of Health under self-quarantine. And I see there were all these optics while we were over there about this big jet that flew over from Wahoon with all the diplomats and business people in it that went into Alaska and then down into San Francisco, wherever it was, on their own quarantine. But when we got back, they shoved us through customs. Nobody checked us. Nobody checked temperature. Nobody checked for anything. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people were coming through the border when we had all these optics going on in our country that we were quarantining everybody who stepped in from that area.
Yeah, that's hard to hear.
So it was kind of shocking to me, but it's like, okay, look, nothing was wrong. I'm fine. And you're absolutely right. People got to realize that the flu is more deadly than this is right now.
I think people recognize that, though, Ron. I think there's no one who doesn't recognize that. I think just people are scared of what they don't know.
That's exactly it. Right. That's exactly it. The problem is we don't have a vaccine for this yet. It makes it more frightening. And like the other stuff that we've had in the past, the MARS, the SARS, the mosquito virus, all of that stuff, we don't know about it. So we have to have something to put our hat on. For the news agencies, it's ways to sell advertising. For the newspapers and the online stuff, it's ways to sell subscriptions. It's just, we look for the next shiny pedal, and this happens to be it outside of politics.
Ron, before I let you go, being in China and while that was going on and coming back and being quarantined, what was it like? Were you worried? Were you thinking about that you were going to get it? What was your thought process as you were going through that?
I was very fortunate. When I first went there, I was staying with my daughter. She teaches over there. And then I had the privilege to stay during the Chinese New Year to stay with a private family for 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
So we got into the suburbs. We got into their homes, and I got to really see the culture from their true point of view rather than staying in a hotel.
Hmm.
And I only got scared toward the end when I saw them discussing it. They were watching their televisions, and they started getting worried about it. And I asked the guy and had to have it translated, hey, because we were planning to get back. Two of our flights were canceled. We were then trying to get out of the country. And I asked him, hey, is my family going to be safe? And because everything's closed mouth over there and everybody gets in trouble for starting rumors, he didn't say anything. At that point, conversation ended. We went off to go do something else. But so I did get a little frightened toward the end when our flights got canceled, but I ended up getting into Beijing and ended up getting out within 9 hours. So, but now that I'm here and I look at how we're treating it and what was going on over there, I was highly impressed with what they were doing. I mean, they had people checking everybody. I used all public transportation while I was there. I was highly impressed with, they had doctors and they had, you know, medical people there taking temperatures, looking at everybody, trying to keep it all down. And, you know, the streets, businesses were closed. The streets were more bare than normal. So, I mean, they were doing their job over there to try to contain it.
Yeah. Ron, thanks for calling, man. That's great. Thanks so much for giving us perspective. I appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Appreciate it.
Yeah, there you go. Wow. I listened to Ron all night. That had to be so tough to be in that spot, to have some sort of outbreak while you're in a foreign land. 312-981-7200. Let's move on, talk local. Coronavirus obviously is local as well, as we concern. Obviously, we live in a big city and a big area in the Midwest, and I'm sure that our leaders here in the Midwest are also thinking about what they can do to prevent and to contain any sort of outbreak that might happen. There are other big stories as well. Heather Sharone joins us every Wednesday here on WGN Radio, and she's with me now. Heather, good to talk to you.
Happy to be here.
When I was talking a little bit about the coronavirus, you covering City Hall, as you do for the Daily Line, is this a constant? Are reporters asking Mayor Lightfoot when there's availabilities, or anyone in City Hall, about preparations and given the kind of the full court press like the national media is doing with the president?
Yes, and the mayor said this morning that everybody needs to take a deep breath and to realize that there has been only limited instances of coronavirus in not only Chicago, but across the United States, so that there's no reason to worry, there's no reason to panic, and that the Department of Health is staying on top of things. There were two confirmed cases of coronavirus, one a woman who had traveled to China several weeks ago and her husband. They were both quarantined and have since recovered and don't appear to have transmitted the disease to anyone else. So the mayor got a little bit frustrated, I think, with the testimony yesterday from the Centers for Disease Control that basically said it could get really bad really fast. And she said, you know, there's no reason for people to be alarmed. You know, just take the precautions that you would take to avoid getting a cold or a flu, and that, you know, we're all going to make it through this. Now, of course, we're learning tonight that there is a confirmed case in Northern California, right, and authorities aren't sure how that person contracted disease because they had no known contact with somebody who traveled to China or had the disease before them. So that's a little bit of a question mark right now.
The hard part here, and I would suggest this, I would think it'd be hard for the mayor, is you show frustration because the sensationalistic approach that the news and everyone is doing, even the CDC in this case. But there is this desire from people who live in the area, that live in the city of Chicago, to get the information and to make sure that the government is doing everything they possibly can. So she's got to ride that fine line of telling everybody to calm down or being frustrated with the news and recognizing that people are really concerned about this.
That's right. It's a very fine line to walk because you don't want to unduly alarm people, but you also want people to take the necessary precautions, and you want to be sure that you're being as open and honest as possible so that if there was sort of some alarm that needed to be sounded, you had a lot of credibility behind what you were saying, and people would sort of sit up and listen and take the appropriate action. That is difficult to do under the best of circumstances, and it's extremely hard to do when, you know, everybody's a little bit freaked out whether or not there's actual good reason to be, you know, suffering a low-grade panic, which would probably say where I am right now.
Right, low-grade panic. That's good. Heather Sharone joining us here. Let's talk, before we get to the affordable housing stuff, which I really want to talk about. The mayor, it's interesting because the mayor has a lot of clout. We've been inundated with former Mayor Emanuel's book about the mayors run the world, and his points out there are mayors on the stage in the Democratic primary, mayors that are even leading in some cases. And it's a little bit, there's a little bit of scratching the head when it comes to why the mayor of Chicago, one of the biggest and most powerful mayors in this with clout and political muscle, has stayed out to this point or has not publicly endorsed a candidate. Is she dodging that question? What's your thought on why she hasn't stepped forward and endorsed a candidate?
Well, she said that she plans to endorse a candidate when the time is right for her. Of course, she, you know, is not one to call up members of the media and share her innermost thoughts and concerns with. And there was a lot of speculation several weeks ago that she was prepared to endorse Mike Bloomberg because before the mayor was the mayor, she had gone through Bloomberg's you know, civic leadership training program, and she's spoken very highly of that program and of Mayor Bloomberg. But we haven't heard anything since. And since then, of course, we saw Mike Bloomberg get dismantled by Elizabeth Warren in the debates and a lot of questions about how he handled stop and frisk in New York, which was a very big issue here in Chicago. You know, the city had to enter an agreement with the ACLU to basically say, we're going to do a better job documenting the stops that we make and ensuring that they're based on probable cause, not somebody's race or ethnicity. So we haven't heard anything since. Maybe she's waiting for the smoke to clear after South Carolina on Tuesday and Super Tuesday after that, because nobody wants to pick a loser.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I was waiting for, right?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, there is something to that. And, you know, I think it was President Obama, this is last time around, the same thing, that there's a little bit of nothing. She doesn't want to jump in and say, Bloomberg's my guy, and then watch Bernie Sanders, you know, cruise on by. There is
that's
some,
right.
That's a big part of what she, I mean, obviously that goes into the calculation when it comes to an endorsement.
I would be very surprised, however, regardless of whether Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren ultimately wins the nomination, I would be surprised that we would see her endorse either of them before they become the presumptive nominee, if in fact either of them do. Both of them came to Chicago during this fall's teacher strike and rallied with the teachers union and was not especially especially complimentary of the mayor's leadership during that very fraught time. So I would not be surprised if the mayor still had that sort of uppermost, maybe not uppermost in her mind, but, you know, in her mind. And the mayor has charted a very pragmatic but progressive course while in office, and there aren't a lot of similarities behind what she's been doing in Chicago with the platforms that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have put out there.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because the Illinois primary was one that everyone thought would just be about the local races, and by the time the presidential primary got to Illinois, it wouldn't matter because we're 2 weeks after Super Tuesday. But as it's kind of shaken out, and it could easily fall in line with what happens in South Carolina, it could very well be in play. Is that part of it, too, to hold back and wait because there's going to be more emphasis and more focus on Illinois than they thought at the beginning?
Sure. This is a throwback to 1992, when Illinois played a rather decisive role in the contest between Bill Clinton and Al Gore. And that was really the last time that the Illinois primary was, you know, really had any impact whatsoever on the outcome. Although Bernie Sanders came very close in 2016 to defeating Hillary Clinton, of course, in her original home state of Illinois. And so, you know, it's been one of those primaries that's sort of, you know, been sort of lumped together without the attention of a New Hampshire or an Iowa caucus or something like that. But it could, you know, it could have more importance this year, especially because there's been more attention to the fact that Illinois as a state is more representative of the demographics of America than perhaps a state like Iowa or New Hampshire or even Nevada.
Now, I would assume most of the candidates skipped putting together ground games or skipped putting ads on the television because of the fact that they didn't think it would matter here. Who has invested? I mean, from your vantage point, your anecdotal vantage point, who has actually invested any ground game or any sort of campaign strategy in Illinois?
Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders both have Chicago offices both in the city and in the suburbs. And if you've turned on the radio at any point in the last couple of weeks, you've heard Mike Bloomberg's ads. If you haven't heard them on the radio, somebody has come up to find you on the street to talk to you about Mike Bloomberg and sort of full court press that is, you know, is costing literally a $500 million. So he's certainly active here. Joe Biden has not really had an Illinois operation up to this point, nor have really any of the other candidates, which you would be a little bit surprised maybe because, of course, Pete Buttigieg is right across the state line from South Bend. But a lot of those campaigns are sort of operating on a let's get from one caucus to the next primary to the next caucus to the next primary to Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And in years past, you know, Super Tuesday has sort of been the whole enchilada, for lack of a better term. And if it doesn't prove to be the whole enchilada, which of course it very may well, things are going to have to be rejiggered and Illinois might find itself in the spotlight a little bit more.
I hope that's the case. Heather Cherone is the managing editor over at the Daily Line, puts out a great newsletter in the morning. This morning she put out a great story about the mayor's plan for affordable housing when it comes to Jackson Park, Woodlawn, and the area that surrounds the Obama Presidential Center. We'll talk about that right after the break here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Heather Cherone joining us here, the Daily Line, as she does every Wednesday night. And it's exciting to talk to this because you had a great piece today about affordable housing when it comes to the Obama Presidential Center. The mayor put together a plan. This on the heels of what I thought was really interesting is that the group Preservation Chicago put out their Chicago 7, which are the endangered buildings and spaces. And their number one is Jackson Park. And they say the Presidential Center plus the golf course that's planned there, that there's a lot of concern about Jackson Park actually being endangered. So it's in the news, and it's interesting that this is bubbling up.
That's right. So when the Obama Presidential Center was approved, there was no provision made by those approvals to say we're going to make sure that the people who lived in Woodlawn for decades are going to be able to stay in Woodlawn. So there was a lot of excitement at the time that, you know, the former president had picked Chicago, he had picked Jackson Park, that there was going to be this $500 million development that really had the potential to transform huge parts of the South Side, which, of course, has been, you know, disinvested in for decades. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is that if there's a huge upsurge in interest in that area, it's oftentimes that the poorest people have suffered, and the mayor's plan really attempts to prevent that from happening. But if you talk to the advocates and the coalition that has been sort of focused on these issues, as well as Alderman Jeanette Taylor, she said that the mayor's plan is woefully insignificant and that it won't really address the fundamental problems that the presidential center could bring.
What are the how do you make sure there's affordable housing? Is a set aside? How do you do that?
Yeah, it's really tough. So there are a couple of things the city can do. And really, the city's biggest leverage, everybody agrees, is the fact that the city owns almost 200 vacant lots in Woodlawn, and that the city owns those lots, so they get to say whatever's going to be built there. And the Coalition for Community Benefits Agreements wants to see the city basically only build affordable housing on those vacant lots and the affordable rental housing, and to make those units available to really very poor people who are struggling to just stay off the streets. However, the mayor's plan sort of divides those lots in half and sets aside half to be used to build owner-occupied homes and half for rental units, and to use a variety of different programs, four programs that she is going to earmark $4.5 million for to sort of make that whole area more welcoming and more vibrant to the people who have lived there. And as another goal is to build up the middle class that really left Woodlawn decades ago, and that could see a return as people want to live near the presidential right. center.
Now, I remember over the summer for Extension 720, we went down to Woodlawn and talked to Reverend Brazier, about
right.
this concept of who's in control of the neighborhood. And they had their own plan. And they said, this is what we're going to do with it. We're going to include the presidential center. We're going to figure this out. Did they get kind of antsy when the mayor comes up with plans that says, here's my ordinance, this is the idea, this is what I'm doing with your neighborhood?
Definitely. So the mayor says she's held an extensive community outreach program. I think the final meeting, the 16th, was held earlier this week to detail the ultimate conclusion of her plan. So she said she's really engaged the people who've lived there, who have been, you know, have been working on this issue. But her plan is not the same as the plan put together by the Coalition for a CBA, and which has the support of 29 aldermen. So in, you know, sort of on paper, that would be enough to get it through the city council. But that's not really how things work, as you and I know, that if you mm-hmm. don't have the backing of the mayor, chances of, you know, even getting a committee hearing can be somewhat dicey. So that's been in limbo really since the fall. And now we have this plan, which could be introduced to the city council as soon as next month. And once that's introduced, you know, then it sort of goes through the process. So we'll see what happens. I think a lot of it will hinge on whether the mayor agrees to negotiate with Alderman Taylor, who wants to see higher protections for lower-income people, and whether or not Alderman Taylor will support it, because I know you and I have talked a lot about aldermanic prerogatives, but it would be a big push to get something like this through the city council without the support of the mm-hmm. alderman whose ward it directly affects.
The one thing, if I'm listening and I don't necessarily live on the south side of Chicago or maybe even in the city of Chicago, this is the way the world works. If Jackson Park, they're going to build up, and everyone said that's okay, even though I would question why we're building on a public park, but that's a different conversation.
Oh, that, yes.
but if this is the case and developers want to come in and build buildings and charge a rent and people want to pay that rent, that's the American way. At what point do you say that government getting involved with all sorts of stipulations on how to keep the people that are there is kind of tricking the system and actually unfair to the people who want to move there?
absolutely. You know, there's an argument to be made that the best way to create affordable housing is to give the market free rein, because the market will build what people will you know, want to live in, and they will charge what people are able and willing to pay. That is certainly an argument. I think that the Community Benefits Agreement Coalition would say, well, you know, we've seen the impact of that, and we've seen long-time residents, mostly poor, mostly black, pushed out of their homes and sort of pushed either into homelessness or other parts of the city that don't really have the infrastructure or the housing to help them, which creates an even bigger problem that the city's going to have to deal with in those neighborhoods, whether, you know, it's overcrowding or crime or congestion or any number of, you know, different things that could result when you sort of move a group of people from one place to another place in the city.
Yeah. And finally, just the Obama Center itself, because the irony here is that the community organizer, Barack Obama, helped many people, Elk Gardens and other places, where he helped the poor on the south side of Chicago to organize and to... He just helped them. That was his thing. That's how he rose the ranks politically. To come back here with a presidential center and to have the possibility that this could hurt the poor, what's the take from the Obama Presidential Center? Where's their stance in this? Because it seems like they're just staring irony in the face.
Yeah, well, they are participating in the working groups. They've been a part of the discussions. But the former president has really steadfastly refused to sign a community benefits agreement, which, of course, he could have done when this was approved under former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And he said, you know, I don't need to sign that agreement. My track record as a community organizer, as a Chicagoan, and as a senator and president should be enough for you guys to trust me that I'm going to take care of the people in this neighborhood. And that just has not simply been good enough for the people of Woodlawn, who have seen, you know, a once really vibrant and bustling neighborhood sort of, you know, become, you know, a place where people drove quickly through, and see this as an opportunity to sort of reverse those declining fortunes of many decades.
What's the next step for this ordinance, for the mayor's ordinance?
Well, we'll see if it gets introduced next month. That would be a big thing. But let's not forget that we're still waiting for the federal government, headed by, of course, President Donald Trump, to sign off on the Obama Presidential to allow it to be built in Jackson Park on what is federal land. So they've got the final say. And every once in a while, I remind myself of that, and I take a deep breath, because who knows what's going to happen.
There are a lot. I mean, I know. And I fall on that side. There are a lot of people in Chicago that really swear by protecting the public parks. And this project was first pitched as the idea to accentuate the park. And then once the designs came out, you're like, nah, this is just taking acres of the park away. And that's something I think that still hasn't been reconciled in the city, not unlike what happened with the museum on the lakefront with the Lucas, the Star Wars Museum. And that's one
100%
thing.
Right.
Yeah, and the lawsuits haven't gone the way of the preservationists, but it's still, I think, a very interesting debate to have in the city of Chicago. Heather Sharone, always a pleasure to have you on Wednesday nights here. She is the managing editor over at the Daily Line. You can find all her stuff on Chicago's Cook County, Springfield, and, of course, get their newsletter, which pops in your mailbox every single morning. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. All right, coming up, Diane Ravitch is going to join us, the longtime educator and, I would say, advocate for public education. She's in town. The book is called Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch, a former Undersecretary of Education in the George H.W. Bush administration, President George H.W. Bush administration. She has a lot to say about No Child Left Behind, standardized tests, a lot of things that we're talking about today. Public education, charter schools, privatization, and what this administration, and not just this administration, what the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, what they've done to really put public education in peril. She's not a fan of the way that the United States government has put public education in their sights. So we'll have that conversation coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. In the 9 o'clock hour, we'll talk about RuPaul's Drag Race and politics, put them together. As we'll have some drag performers in studio to talk about the new movement in the gay community in Chicago called Drag Yourself to the Polls. The idea of trying to get getting the gay community politically motivated for the upcoming election. And at 10 o'clock, the last swap meet with Greg Flamm. So we got lots to do tonight. So let's get to it right after Vic Vaughn's news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has been a leading voice in American education for years. Diane Ravitch has written several books about public education and served as the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. She's a historian of education, currently a professor at NYU. The list goes on and on and on. Her new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch, my guest tonight, 720 WGN. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin.
Before we start, I was amazed about when we see a historian for public education, for education. Take us back to how this began, public education.
Well, if you go back to the beginning, it'd be back in, let's say, the early 19th century, at which time education was available only to the children of the wealthy. There were a few church schools. But basically, if you're poor, you didn't get educated. You went to work on the farm or wherever you could find any work, and there were no public schools. And it was great invention in the 1820s when Horace Mann decided that it made sense to create a public school system. And he was the leader and founder of public education in America. Others began to think, well, you know, this is a really great idea because if we're going to stay a democracy, everyone should know how to read and should know how to write. And so it was a very, in a sense, a simple idea, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And most kids didn't get more than a few years of schooling. And the schooling calendar was wrapped around the agricultural calendar so that kids could help planting and help their families out. But it was during the 19th century that public education was established. And it was considered by the early 20th century one of the great wonders of the world.
Was it controversial? I mean, was it controversial in being established? Was there pushback to the idea of making education public?
Well, there was some controversy, basically around the idea of establishing high schools, because there were a lot of wealthy people who said, why should we pay for high schools? Why should we be taxed so that other people's children can go to high school? So there was a court fight about that in the 1870s, and there were fights over religion because there were people who said that the public schools were too Protestant-oriented, and as long as you're supporting Protestant schools, you should also support Catholic schools. So there were great battles in cities up and down the Eastern Seaboard about whether Catholic schools should be public supported. But eventually it was resolved that public schools would be separated, that there would be separation of church and state, and that public schools would be public.
It's an amazing story. And I asked, you know, obviously saw a lot of the themes, even in just telling that small sort of summary of the beginning of public education, a lot of those fights are happening today. I mean, there continues to be this controversy over something that many believe in the entire world is the gem of American society.
Well, I think for most of our history, at least since public education was well established, and that would have been by the late 19th century, so for more than the last 100 years, most people would say that one of the great accomplishments of American society was free and universal public education, because in most nations in the world that had education, it was only for the wealthy, and people had to pay for education. And when public education first started here, there were tuition schools, and then the idea of making all schools free and open to everyone, and of course open to everyone meant mostly open to white kids, mm-hmm. but then after the Brown decision, the push was open to all kids. And we still have these battles. They're going on. Almost everything that I mentioned as an issue is still an issue today.
It's in your book. I mean, even talking about charter schools and privatization, school choice, we see a lot of these things thrown around, even in the State of the Union that we just saw. All those issues are the same kind of issues that have been a part of public education's history since the beginning.
Right. And the interesting thing about school choice was that it was associated with the segregation movement. So that in the 1950s, when the Brown decision came down in 1954, the southern states responded to it by saying, let's have school choice. Let's let everybody choose, and the white kids will go to the white schools, and the black kids will go to the black schools. They'll be too terrified.
It's a workaround.
We'll make sure that they're terrified, and that will maintain segregation. So the term school choice, which is now thrown about by the president and the secretary of education, was stigmatized. And for many decades, people never used the term because it was a synonym for racial segregation.
I think a lot of people wouldn't know that, and especially because it doesn't matter which political party. You're getting school choices thrown around, even from the last administration. And school choice is considered, you know, those two words put together, there is no connotation to it, but there is.
But that's the history of it, is that when you go back and you look at the reaction of the Southern governors, Southern senators, they were all in favor of school choice, but all for the same reason.
Diane Ravitch is with me. She's the author of Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. I'll take a quick break here. We'll come back more with Diane here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. Diane Ravitch is here. She's a longtime leader in public education and is a professor at NYU. She's written several books, including her latest, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. The first segment, we talked a lot about the history, and it's really just a setup. When did public education, maybe it was from the beginning, but when did public education become political?
I think that you could in a sense say that it was always political because people have always battled over who was going to control the schools. There was a fairly settled idea that public schools should be controlled locally and that states were primarily responsible for public education. And the federal government had a very limited role. In 1965, under Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society program, he created a funding stream, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, to send money to schools that were impoverished. And that was the real beginning of serious federal involvement in the schools. But it was understood when that act was passed that the federal government would not tell schools what to teach or how to teach. And Republicans were afraid that the Democrats might control it, and Democrats were afraid the Republicans might control it.
Right.
So it wasn't until George W. Bush became president that the federal government passed a truly intrusive piece of legislation.
This was No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind.
Right, of course.
And No Child Left Behind said, you will have test every child from grades 3 through 8 every year. And there has to be yearly progress. And by 2014, this was in 2002 that the legislation was passed. By 2014, every child in America will be proficient or your school will be punished. This was based on a hoax. The hoax was the so-called Texas Miracle. And George W. Bush ran for office. And this was his big idea, was if he was a compassionate conservative, and we could fix the schools by testing every child every year because it worked in Texas. Well, we now know 20 years later it didn't work in Texas. It was a hoax. Texas has mediocre test scores. And every time you hear about a miracle and its education, don't believe it. It's not true.
And you write about it, too. There has the canaries in the coal mine, if you will, have been the teachers. Teachers have recognized that the standardized testing movement in this country, which is very young. I mean, like you said, it was 2004. That quickly that these tests don't mean anything, and they're applying them and making kids go through this. And there are some instances where some teachers just walked out or refused to give the test. We had that issue here in Chicago as well, where it said, you know what, this is not the right kind of test for our kids. As a society, how do we take that? Do we look at that and see that the teachers are our frontline, the frontline soldiers in the fight for public education? Or do we look at that and say, you know what, the president was right at the time that people are getting in the way of truly getting to accountability?
Well, the whole notion of accountability is the way it's practiced with standardized tests is ridiculous. The only beneficiaries of this regime of testing every child every year for 3 through 8, the only beneficiary are the testing companies. They're making billions of dollars. Mm. The kids are not benefiting because we find out year after year the same thing. The standardized tests are normed on a bell curve. The kids on the top half of the curve are primarily white and middle class, upper middle class.
With the resources to be able to.
Right. And, you know, they come from stable homes with educated parents. And what you're basically measuring with standardized tests is family income and family education. And once in a while, you'll find kids who break that pattern. But on the whole, time and time again, the poor kids predominate in the bottom half, the kids who don't have good command of English, and the kids who have disabilities will be in the bottom half. So we are not learning anything.
Yeah, you're one of the most foremost leaders in education. You've served in government. When you're pointing this out, you point it out in the book, but you're pointing out to others, is it just really the lobby of test organizations being able to make money? Is that really what this is all about?
You know, what's frustrating, having worked in Washington, having talked to members of Congress about this, is they don't really care much about education. Mm. They do in theory, but in fact, they don't pay attention to it. So when you tell them that the testing is producing nothing, what I show in my book is we have this one measure. It's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. I was on the board for 7 years, and it got very frustrating because year after year the results would come in, and I'd say, what changed? Nothing. Nothing changed. The rich kids are at the top. The poor kids are at the bottom. We've learned nothing. And then when it gets down to the level of the school, the teacher administers the test in March, and the results come in usually in August or September. The kids aren't even in the same class, don't have the same teacher.
Yeah, right, right.
And the information the teacher gets is not helpful. It doesn't say, Johnny needs more of this and Jane needs less of
that. How do you build to actually improve year after year in these tests if they're not having any consistency?
Well, it's not even that they don't have consistency, but they don't give any information other than you got this score and you got that score. They don't tell you where your strengths and weaknesses are. They're a total and complete waste of time. And so when I say that the congressmen and senators don't pay attention, they really don't pay attention to the details. All they know is testing is good, accountability is good, we have to have more testing. And then when you get to the state legislators, they'll say, well, we have to have more tests, and we have to test more often and make the test harder, and the kids will get smarter if the tests are harder. This is all, they're talking like fantasy land. Mm-hmm. The tests are worthless.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. She's got a brand new book out, which is called Slaying Goliath. We're talking about it here on 720 WGN. One of the areas that you really focus on is the privatization of American public education, and at least the attempt. And it continues. We see it through different ways. Charter schools is one that obviously people know about, and a lot of people don't. That might be one of the problems, too. Diane, you talk about disruptors. And when I hear that word, disruptors, I always think of it as a good word for the business community, startups who are changing the way we look at technology or changing the way we do things and patterns. Your version of the word disruptor is a little bit more nefarious.
Right. I was trying to find a way to take away the word reformer, because the people who are out to privatize public education, who want to have charter schools, vouchers, online virtual schools, have the government pay for homeschooling, have all this public money transferred to religious institutions, they're not reformers. In my mind, having studied education reform over many years, reformers are people who want to make the schools better, who want teachers to be paid more, who want to have the schools more integrated, who think of ways to make public education more successful than it is today. But the people now calling themselves reformers are actually trying to disrupt public education in a business sense. They're corporate. I sometimes call them corporate reformers, because they take the corporate lingo and they apply it to schools where it's really not appropriate at all. You really don't want to disrupt.
Well, we hear that all
lives.
The time from politicians too, who are running, saying we want to run these schools like a business.
Right, and that's a horrible thing, to run schools like a business. I lived through 12 years of that in New York City, and it just doesn't work. It leads to manipulating numbers, having PR that announces great successes, and the successes disappear overnight. And it's, you know, typical corporate PR. But with schools, what you need is steadiness of purpose, experienced teachers. You need the resources so that children have music and art and band and the opportunity to play. There are all kinds of things that schools need, a nurse in every school, mm-hmm. Social workers. I mean, kids today, I have to say, are in deep trouble. I mean, in Chicago, for example, 90% of the kids are in poverty. These kids have traumatic backgrounds, many of them. In Cleveland, it's about 100% of the kids live in poverty. Mm. Nationally, 50% of the kids
are
low income.
Is it because in public education, the kids that you talked about, that bell curve, have opted out, have gone somewhere else, and now public education is really there to serve people who might be living in traumatic experiences or poor kids?
No, I'm talking about American children. And American children, I mean, despite all the talk about our booming economy, half of the kids in this country, wherever they live, half of the kids qualify for free or reduced price lunch, which is the federal definition of poverty.
Right.
20% of the kids are 21, somewhere around that number, live in dire poverty. So I'm not sure why the economy is booming and kids are not doing well, but that means that a lot of kids are not getting health care, are not getting nutrition, and are not coming to school ready to learn. And these are the deep social problems that are more important than test scores.
Well, that's what we heard. I think we all heard in the teacher strike here in Chicago over the fall. And it was a moment that it wasn't about salary. It wasn't necessarily about the things that we usually will see surround a teacher strike. It was about really kind of looking at inequity and recognizing that there's a real issue right now when it comes to kids in Chicago who aren't of the have-nots, not the haves.
Right. I was just recently in Los Angeles, and they also had a teacher strike, and they were striking for the same issues as in Chicago. They want to reduce class sizes, and they had talked to me about classes that had 40 and 45 children. Yeah.
That's it's, Chicago, too, right?
And when you have children who don't speak English, children with handicaps, children with lots of problems that they're bringing from home, and there are 45 children in a classroom and some kids are sitting on the floor, that's insane. Mm. They were also striking because they wanted a nurse in every school. I mean, that's not a very radical demand. I went to school in Houston, Texas, public school. Was not an affluent, high-income school. We had a nurse every day. We had arts every day. Why do teachers have to go on strike to get a librarian and a library in every school? I mean, the fact is that we underfund public schools. And I know that the mantra that we've heard from the far right for years has been that we're throwing money at schools. We are not throwing money at schools. Teachers, for the most part, are not paid as professionals.
Well, let's
and
do this.
Class sizes are way too large, and there should be a nurse and a librarian in every school.
I want to pick it up right there. Let's take a quick break. Diane Ravitch is my guest. Her book is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. A former assistant secretary of education under President George H.W. Bush, a professor at NYU. Diane Ravitch, my guest here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Diane Ravitch is here. Her book is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization, the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. She, of course, one of the foremost leading experts when it comes to education in this country. Served in the U.S. Department of Education under President George H.W. Bush. She's a professor at NYU, has done so much, and the list goes on and on. Diane, I'm amazed. Let's pick it up where we left off, just the idea of underfunding schools. Because you hear this all the time, and the president uses words like failing, that the schools are failing. And you'll hear this all the time. You kind of get it on both sides of the aisle. I don't want to make it just one political side or a partisan issue. How do you push back on that? The idea, because they'll point to stats and say it's failing. That's why we need charter schools. That's why we need private. That's why we need to put money in different places, because the public education system is failing.
Well, first of all, the public system is not failing. I'd say our society is failing. Our society is failing to take care of its children. We're not investing in the future. We're not investing in children. And we're letting children go without adequate medical care. We're letting young women who become pregnant deliver babies without ever having seen a doctor. I mean, there are so many things that we're doing that are just plain wrong, and they're far more important than test scores. The test scores are a reflection of the larger society. I think if we took care of the children and took care of the families, test scores would take care of themselves. Mm. But we've had policies over the past 20 years, all the testing and now the push for charters and privatization that have been extremely demoralizing to teachers. And there are teacher shortages all over the country, in part because salaries are really inadequate in most places. As I demonstrate in the book, most states are spending less today on schools than they were in 2008.
How is that possible? Is it that the fight to privatize public education is winning? That less tax money is going to schools because of charter schools and choice and other places? Is that why and how is it even possible that we are underfunding education 10 years after the fact?
Well, it's a fact that we are, and about 29 or 30 states are actually spending less than they were. And most of these, if not all of them, are red states where they followed a policy of when the recession hit in 2008, they adopted austerity budgets. They cut taxes. They cut corporate taxes. That means less revenue for schools. Then when the economy got better, they didn't restore the big cuts, or they restored them in such small measure that it really made no difference. They barely kept up with inflation. But I think the other thing that's been very damaging is that there's been a press, particularly from the far right, to substitute choice for adequate funding. And I've documented this in the book, where you have families like the Waltons.
These are some of the disruptors you point out.
What I call the disruptors, the Walton family, who own all Walmart. Walmart's not unionized. They don't want unionized schools, so they like to have charter schools that are non-union. And more than 90% of the charters in this country are non-union. Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, hates public schools, funds vouchers, and funds candidates who support vouchers. And there's a hugely important Supreme Court decision coming up this term called Espinosa versus Montana. Montana in 1972 wrote a constitution where they said all public money goes to public schools. And one family said, but we want to go to a religious school and we think the government should pay for it. That's now before a court that is very pro, they call it religious freedom, but what they really mean is transferring government money to religious schools. If the court rules in favor of the Espinosa family, that could devastate public
That'll
education budgets across the country.
So these disruptors, what do they want? Because you mentioned with the Waltons, they want a non-union school, whatever they want. Well, what is, at the end of the day, is it better education? Is it less taxes? What's at the heart of trying to move away from public education?
Well, what they want is libertarianism. They want everyone to make their own choices. They don't care about quality. They want lower taxes. The Waltons right now are in court in a number of places to lower the property taxes on Walmarts. Now, if you lower the property taxes on Walmart, that's obviously going to hurt public education as well.
But that's where I see, I think a lot of our listeners right now will say, I can understand that correlation. I can understand that you would want, corporations would want to lower the taxes, and in doing so, that would underfund public, because that's where public education gets their money from. That's the whole deal, right?
They don't want to invest in the future. And so they have taken what is the truth. And the truth is our public schools should be far better than they are. And many children, particularly black and brown children, are not getting the quality of education they should. They're in overcrowded, crumbling schools. Mm-hmm. And they're in schools that don't have all the resources that they need. They've taken that truth and used it to sell a lie, which is that the answer, therefore, is to send them to religious schools and to charter schools that are not accountable and that may reject them, first of all, because they have disabilities, may reject them because they don't read English, may kick them out because they have behavior issues, and may close in the middle of the year. I mean, charter schools have a long history of...
That's just happened here in Chicago today.
They open and they close like daylilies.
Yeah.
And there, in some states, there are more charters closing than there are charters opening. So they are like businesses in that sense. You don't expect your hot dog stand or your shoe store to be there forever, but somehow you think your public school is going to
be
there.
Right?
It's going to be a regular presence in your community.
Let me play devil's advocate for someone who lives in Chicago, who lives in an impoverished neighborhood, high violence, and recognizes that the public school, under-resourced for all the reasons that you've stated, is just not an ample... a desired location to send their kids. That would be where a charter school or choice could come in, and a charter school could open up and give them opportunities. And we've seen this. Now, is that does that on paper, is that logic sound? The idea that choice in that form, where someone doesn't want to go because they don't trust the public school.
Well,
does that kind of work?
No, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because public schools are supposed to meet the needs of all children, not some children. So if you say, well, we're going to run two different public schools in the same neighborhood, one we'll call a charter, and it can choose the students it wants, it'll be open to everybody, but it'll kick out whoever it doesn't want. So it'll keep the kids it wants, and it'll push out the ones that are not doing the work that they want, who are not walking in a straight line and meeting all of their standards of no excuses discipline. And then the public school becomes the dumping ground. Is this going to make for a better society in the future, or would we be better off having a public school that is well-resourced and that is attractive to all the children in that neighborhood, that has highly experienced teachers, that has classes no larger than 18, that has all the resources that would be available if they were living in a suburb? That, to me, is a far better answer than creating a dual-track system. We already had dual schools in this country, and they were supposed to have been abolished many years ago.
You see public school systems, Chicago is one of them, and you see this in other big cities, I think New York has done this, where they almost create the tracks internally, not get charter schools out of the business. They're just saying, we're going to have magnet schools or selective enrollment schools, where they're doing effectively the same thing, where they're taking students who are high performing out of certain neighborhoods, taking them to the good schools that are resourced and funded, and leaving everybody else behind in an unfunded school. Is that similar in the concept as these they figured out a way to keep some of the more affluent people in those school districts?
I think that it's similar to an extent, and I don't entirely approve of that. I think that it's wrong to separate out the kids who get high test scores and say, we're going to have a special school for you. I think that I went to a comprehensive school myself, and I went to an untracked school. And I think that you learn a lot by going to school with kids that are different from you, and you may be good in math and not good in history, and the other kids may be different. And I think that's fine. I think that within the school there are going to be kids who will say, well, I'm going to take advanced math. Not everybody's going to take advanced math.
Right,
not everybody's going to take physics. That's okay. But I think that the effort ought to be a simple goal called equality of educational opportunity. And when we abandon that, and this is the whole problem with the testing regime, is that it ranks kids, you're the best, you're the worst. The best kids get the highest performing of everything and the best of everything, and the rest will throw in the gutter. And that's not right.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. Her new book, Slaying Goliath, is out now, and we're talking about public education in this country and in this city here on 720 WGN. President Trump and the Department of Education, you saw signals this past month that there is a course change. I don't know if it's a course change, but the idea that charter schools, it doesn't seem like he's interested in charter schools. He had mentioned, he kind of signaled that charter schools, he had pointed out somebody in the State of the Union and said they were going to a failing public school, and now I've got him a scholarship to a private school, and everyone cheered, thinking it was a public school, but it turned out that student was from a charter school. And so they're, and then even doubling down, saying he may not even be interested in charter schools and private. Do, from your point of view, when you see that the president is stepping out of line with some of the issues that are in your book, is that good? Is that bad? Is it in a different direction? Where do you see a president who obviously has a different approach to education as it relates to this book?
Well, to begin with, I don't think President Trump has given 5 minutes of thought to education since he was elected. But Betsy DeVos has spent her entire adult life advocating for vouchers. So the new line that we see, which is vouchers are everything, and it's not going to be passed by this Congress because of the House being controlled by Democrats, the new line reveals the true Betsy DeVos, which is she would like to see billions and billions of dollars available for students to go to religious schools. And the great lie there is that they will have the same choice as rich kids, which is ridiculous because rich kids, their families will spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to send them to an elite private school, whereas the vouchers will be worth about $4,500 or $5,000. And we already know how they work. There have been many studies of vouchers in Florida and Louisiana and Ohio and Indiana and the districts of Columbia. And in fact, the kids who go to voucher schools do worse than the peers that they left behind. And they do worse because the teachers are not as well qualified. In some voucher schools, like in Florida, high school dropouts can be teachers. So, and they're teaching bogus science taken from the Bible and bogus history. So it's really a program to dumb down the American population. Why does she want to do this? I guess because she's a religious zealot. But it's a very scary moment because people who understand what's at stake, which is the future of public education, have to be very concerned. And I think it's also a telling moment for the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party under Obama and Duncan went the route of charters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now the Democratic Party has realized that this is part of the, this has been part of the Trump-DeVos agenda, that it's part of the school choice movement, and that they've made a mistake.
Well, that's, I was going to say, because it's easy to say, you know, that and it's, you can be partisan and say, okay, I don't like the way that the right might look at schooling. I don't like the way the left is. But in this case, in the last 2-3 administrations, they've all been reform-minded in the way that they put foot forward, saying we've got to fix public schools. But the way they go about it, even Obama, they go about it in a way that most educators are scratching their head.
Well, the important thing,
including you,
the important thing to understand about charters is we now have 30 years of experience. There is today a crisis of corruption in the charter sector, and there's a hashtag on Twitter called "Another Day, Another Charter Scandal." And I could spend another hour with you discussing the charter scandals that have taken place in every part of this country. I mean, charters are among the lowest performing schools in Nevada, among the lowest performing schools in the state of Ohio. They're the biggest charter scandal in our history. Just broke about 8-9 months ago in California, where an online charter operator was indicted for scamming $50 million.
Yeah. Is that because there's no accountability? They're running it like a business? This is the same kind of thing you see in business? Where
it's because there's no, there's almost no oversight. They chose an authorizers who were 500 miles away, so no one checks the books. And then on those rare occasions when they do check the books, they find out that they're collecting money for ghost students. And almost 40% of the charters that have been funded by the federal government have either closed soon after opening or never opened at all.
If you get rid of the – and this is my last question for you. You get rid of the word reform, right? You mentioned disruptors instead.
It's a corrupt word.
What's next for – is it going to have to be a politician who comes in with a different administration, different policy? How are we far gone when it comes to public education charter and the way that this huge, what seems to be a monster of charter schools and vouchers and choice and public education is moving, and so hard to move it in a different direction. Are you optimistic that it can change? Are you pessimistic?
I think that, well, first of all, I'm optimistic that, as my book shows, everything that these so-called reformers have done has actually failed. Charters have not proven to be a panacea. They, in more cases than not, they failed. They have not closed the gap for black and white kids or for brown and black and white kids. Vouchers have been a dismal failure. So at some point, they have to recognize that their strategies don't work. And there are a whole bunch of other things having to do with punishing teachers. Those certainly don't work. And so it's time for fresh thinking. The status quo is no child left behind, race to the top, all these very punitive, test-driven programs. And the answers are not privatization. The answers are to reinvigorate and revive and rebuild our public schools with the resources they need for the children they serve, and to recognize that the most important thing we can do is to make sure that our children are well-fed and have medical care, and that we have jobs for their parents, and that we build our society. Mm. It's a huge order. I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but we can't avoid root causes, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Diane Ravitch, great to have you. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. Nice to meet you. The author of Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Thanks again.
Thank you, Justin.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Justin Kaufman with you. Thanks to Diane Ravitch for the interview. Her book is called Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization, The Fight to Save America's Public Schools. We didn't talk about the story, it's too local, but the story of the NWEA standardized test, where the CPS's inspector general this week brought up the fact that the first way it kind of came out was saying scandal, cheating scandal. The idea that this test that is administered and used for not just evaluation of students, but for entrance into selective enrollment, whether that be for academic centers or selective enrollment high schools, things like that, that this test was essentially being administered wrong. That it was supposed to be a high stress test, this idea of a time test. The creator of this test said it's a 60-minute to an hour and a half test. And that schools have figured out, because they're not being, I guess, monitored in this way, that it's better to administer that test over time, 6 hours, over a couple of days, whatever it might be. And that inevitably is against the rules or is trying to game the system. I've heard of game the system. When they say game the system or scandal or cheating, automatically, when you get to the, you say, ooh, whoa, I can check this out. Start reading it, and you're like, oh, this is 1 hour, 6 hour. You're like, all right. Not really gaming the system. That might not be the right word to use. But it effectively says that it's not being administered to everyone the same way, that some schools may be going by what the time allotment is, and others have bent the rules in that regard. And so this has become a big deal because this is the test that gets kids into the best schools in Chicago. And in many ways, and the reason why it's they call it scandal or corrupt is it's also good overall standard grades. If a school in Chicago is getting a good overall number of an NWEA test, they get more money. So schools have figured out, well, students do better if the test is administered over a certain number of hours, then they do better, we do better. That's the idea. But here's my rub, and the reason I bring it up is because I am very familiar with this test, because this has been, well, having a son who is in Chicago Public Schools, he has been taking this test since third grade. And I can't speak to the idea of how long they take. When you ask your 11-year-old, your 12-year-old, hey, how long do you take that test? I don't know. So I don't have any, my journalist skills failed me at breakfast this morning. How long do you take that NWA test? Hey, Dad, can I tell you about Pokemon? Yeah, all right, no. The question, though, is he's in seventh grade. This seventh grade class, because of this scandal, will be put in a predicament, in a precarious situation where this test where they have to take in a month's time, 2 months' time, whatever it is here, will be the number, the score that they get in this test will be a big part of which school they're going to get into. So the idea that an inspector general comes out in the end of February with this big scandal saying the way that the test is being administered is wrong, right before these kids across the city are going to take this test in seventh grade, therefore putting the applied pressure on the schools to change the way they do the test, which also would change the way that they were teaching to the test, seems to be unfair to me. Why not just say, all right, you know what? Everybody gets this much time, 5 hours, 6 hours, and next year we'll change it. So there are more months to lead up to it. Because last year's crop that are now freshmen at Walter Payton or Northside Prep or Whitney Young High School, they were bending the rules, according to the inspector general. But nobody is going to go back and check their numbers, right? Nobody's going to say, hey, Tommy, I know you're a freshman at Lane Tech High School, but how long did that test take? And so the question just becomes, when you start playing with the idea around the idea of scandal and gaming the system, and you want it to go back to a proper way, when was it proper? Were schools in last year doing it the right way, and this is the first year that they've given students more time to take the test, or probably 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 15 years ago? And when there's so much on the line for these kids there's so much pressure already, it's ridiculous. The amount of pressure that the Chicago Public Schools puts on kids to get into selective enrollment high schools, it's like getting into Harvard. It's like getting into college. Sans the essay. I have to write an essay. Why should I write this essay? This is why I write this essay. So I don't know the answer to it, but it seems to me that you're going to start getting a lot of parents upset at the idea that you're correcting a system in the middle of the system. If you can point to a point where, like in the Houston Astros cheating scandal, where in 2017 they were doing this and they won, blah, 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 that's fine. But this seems to be a gradual and systemic bending of or interpretation of the rule. I don't even think it was bending. I don't think it was breaking the rule. I think it was an interpretation by different schools. Being able to look and saying, you know what, it doesn't matter how long we have to, that's a suggested time. Nobody's enforcing this. So how can you turn around and penalize a class that is in 2020 and make them take a test by a completely different rule and not change the numbers in which they have to hit to get into those schools? So let's say that the test gets you 200 points, right? And with the extra time, you're getting a 180, 190. Wow, great. 200. Awesome. Now with the 1 hour, the kids are rushed. They're doing it differently than the way that they kind of were taught to it. So their number dips. to a 160, a 170? Will the number that you need to get into Whitney Young or to Lane Tech or to the other selective enrollment schools, will that number dip? Or will it continue to stay at 200? Or the threshold saying that's the number? See, that's the problem I have with all. This is why this whole thing needs to be thrown out. This idea that you're doing a standardized test out of nowhere, that really, as Diane pointed out, all that stuff is probably more about the companies that administer the test or sell the test than it is about the assessment of the student. But the idea that you're going to change the rules in midstream, move the goalpost, if you will, to a generation, to an entire seventh grade class, seems mortifying. To just think in the process of chirpy parents when they get to eighth grade and their kid didn't get into Whitney Young or Lane Tech, you think they're not going to point back and go, this is why? You're setting it up to fail. Christine, good to talk to you, Christine. She says, NWEA is only one of three components. Yeah, I know. I'm aware. But the entire idea of the way that Chicago Public Schools works to get your kids into school is that you need to essentially do perfect in all three parts. You have to have straight A's in seventh grade. You have to test well in an admissions test at the beginning of eighth grade. And you have to do your seventh grade NWEA. This is about the story that the inspector general had from the school, the CPS inspector general this week was about the NWEA. So a 10-point swing will doom a student. If a student is expecting to have, because they've taken this test this way for 5 years and they prepared themselves to show a year-to-year improvement, and they have an idea that they know they've got 3 hours to attack the entire math portion, and right before they start, the math teacher says, you got 35 minutes. You don't think that their little brains are going to get anxiety ridden and start to cut corners to try and get the thing done? And that cut corner is 10 points because they missed didn't carry the one. Another 10 points here, another 10 points there because they didn't finish the test. And they're staring at instead of a 200, a 150. It doesn't matter what they do with the other two legs. So that's my point. This is why the whole system is flawed to begin with. And to have the inspector general come out and say that the schools are not abiding by the spirit of the test. That's the one thing I would probably have internal. Have that brought to the CPS administrators and the teachers and everything. Say internal as opposed to let the media FOIA that. As opposed to going out and putting a press release out. Because you've got parents completely scared out of their bejeebus about this. Because you're messing with the idea that they have set up about their lives and where they're going to go to school. It's just another strike against the city of Chicago and the way that they run their education system. For a lot of middle-class parents who have options will take those options and go somewhere else. To move out of the city and you need another person leaves with the tax base. To send to private schools or charter schools or to all the things that Diane's talking about. You expect more out of public education. And that to me is something that will be, it's going to be very interesting in the next couple months. It'll be a story that's going to get bigger and bigger, not smaller and smaller. 312-981-7200, our phone number. 224 says, we use that test. We hate it. I'm assuming that's a teacher. Yep. Christine says, I agree with you completely. I don't expect they'll punish kids from this. Well, shall see. Who are they going to punish otherwise? The schools? Once the schools realize they're going to be punished, they're going to be like, we'll comply. We don't care what happens to little Stevie's grades. We need to comply. Coming up, drag them to the polls. RuPaul's Drag Race is season 12 begins on Friday. And one of the two biggest events of the weekend are going to be the South Carolina primary and RuPaul's Drag Race. Put them together, drag them to the polls, a civic effort to get the gay community involved in the election, which is coming up on March 17th. We'll talk about that with a drag queen in studio, as well as Richard Streetman, who is organizing this event. We'll do all that after Vic Vaughn's news, which is right now on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. It's Justin Kaufman. It is 720 WGN. We're on the air till 11 o'clock. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it'll be our final. This is so hard because it's our final swap meet. This is a segment we've been doing since 2016. Every Wednesday, where Greg Flamm comes in and you tell us about your memorabilia, your collectibles, the trash that's in your attic, and whether it's worth anything. And Greg goes through and lets you know if you got a gem or you just toss it. And we've been doing it for 4 years, and Greg let me know last week that he is leaving. He's moving. He's moving out of the city, and he is moving to a different state. So tonight will be the last swap meet. I'm very bummed about that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we'll have that coming up at 10 o'clock tonight. All right, so let's get into our next segment. So this week there are going to be two big television moments that'll bring people in front of their TVs and assorted devices. You got the South Carolina primary, which will be Saturday, and RuPaul's Drag Race, which, of course, is on Friday night. So what happens when you merge them both? A show like no other at Hamburger Mary's in Chicago's Andersonville neighborhood. Friday, it's called Drag Them to the Polls, and it'll feature members of the drag community performing and raising awareness for the Illinois primary. And, of course, watch the season premiere of RuPaul's Drag Race, which premieres on Friday night. And this is just the start of a coordinated campaign to get out the vote in the gay community. In studio tonight, the organizer, Richard Streetman, and drag performer, Foxy Kim. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Foxy Kim. So right off the bat, it's probably the best political name to have, but this name has nothing to do with Kim Fox.
Totally unintentional. I've been doing drag for longer than when she was first, famous for getting elected. My drag name totally comes from an anagram of my real name and my middle name. So if you like puzzles and word puzzles, you can actually figure out what my first and middle name are.
From Kimmy Fox.
Foxy Kim.
Foxy Kim. Yeah.
So if you rearrange some things, you can actually figure it
right.
out. And then when she was up for election, I probably got about 20 to 30 messages on Facebook and text going, is this you? Is this some kind of like big political joke?
Are you running for state's attorney?
Yeah, right. I was like, no, it's not that. I don't have that kind of degree.
Did you let Jussie Smollett go? That's what people want to know.
No, I had nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that. Well, how long have you been performing drag?
So about 6.5 years.
Yep. Mm-hmm. What got you into it?
So it was actually kind of an interesting turn of events that got me into it. So I'd been doing cosplay for a really long time, going to all the conventions, ASIN, Anime Central, one of the big ones here in Chicago, and really comfortable in that. And a friend approached me about the Front Runner, Front Walker LGBTQ running group, and they have a stage, the Party Mile, over in Boys Town for the Chicago Marathon. And he asked if I wanted to perform and, on stage and be one of the cheerleaders, quote unquote, in drag. And I said, well, yeah, that sounds awesome. I want to do it. And it was the theme was gay marriage. And so we all did bridesmaids outfits, the kind of protest, the legislation mm-hmm. that was sort of anti-gay marriage. And it was a lot of fun to do that. And it was kind of a political moment. And
there's one thing to be in cosplay, which is dressing up like superheroes and other mm-hmm. things and going to the conventions and walking around. There's another to be a drag performer because that's on stage. There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, my audience was 40,000 people for the first time I ever stood on stage. I thought I was the hottest thing in the world. You couldn't have told me anything. I look back on that now and I'm like, wow, that was rough.
So now 6.5 years later, what kind of performer are you, and where do we see you? Because I know you're doing this on Friday. You got other things as well, but what kind of performance can we expect?
So I am very high energy. Everyone kind of calls it the Foxy Stomp, where I just stomp around the stage. Richard's probably seen me, and I just bounce around stage. It's got to be 150 BPM or higher, or I'm not interested in performing the song. So really, really high energy. I do a lot of cosplay shows. So this Friday after the event, I will be at Geek House, which is every last Friday of the month. It's a cosplay themed show. We're having an after hours kind of C2E2 party at Berlin. So I'm really excited
right
to
there
do
in
that.
Belmont. Yeah,
yeah. We're doing fan fiction. So it's like storylines of characters you'd never know. And I'm gonna do Sonic and Tails. So I'm doing a fox character with a friend of mine, Mickey Morales. She's going to be Sonic and I'm going to be Tails, and we're doing this whole new storyline.
What is it? And there are a lot of documentaries about cosplay, and there's some great ones. I saw one on HBO just about the community that mm-hmm. goes from convention to convention. But for you, what is it What's the power in dressing up like your favorite fictional character?
It really brings your fantasy to life, and it brings like what you want to escape to. To me, it's like an escapism a little bit, in a healthy way. And it's a way of, you know, you really get into the lore and into the background of things, and it's a way for you to interpret that and show what you think that should be. And to me, that's like one of the coolest things about cosplay.
Is that similar with drag? Is it the same concept of playing out fantasy?
Yeah, that's why I think, for me personally, that's why I really like the two merged together, is because of the way they allow you to, you know, have that playing a fantasy, and that playing out of these fully realized characters. Foxy is a fully realized character, and she has brands. She loves White Claw, Taco Bell. She is Sicilian, and she will remind you of those three things.
Foxy Kim will be on stage at Hamburger Mary's coming up on Friday for the premiere of RuPaul's Drag Race, which is season 12 here. I want to bring Richard in, who's the organizer, because Richard, and we had you on this summer when we came out to Boys Town to talk about the neighborhood. You've been a long time.
It was off the record.
It was off. That's right. The right. Off the record.
I don't know if anyone heard it.
But. We heard it. What? Why merge these two? Politics. You've been a long time player in gay politics in Chicago. Why merge this with the drag community?
I don't know. Maybe I'm bipolar. Probably. But the simplest explanation is this. I have done politics since I was too young to vote. And I started in South Carolina, so I like to think the primary has been scheduled for my convenience, not just Jim Clyburn's. And, you know, how do you get people to pay attention to politics? Full disclosure, if you Google me, I do have a day job. Drag them to the polls. It's nonpartisan. We'll take anyone of any party. All we're trying to do is get people registered to vote, know about when voting's happening. We're totally voter education. We're not endorsing any candidates. But my day job, if you look me up, it's a guy named Jacob Meister running for clerk of court.
You had to get that in, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not telling you to vote for Jacob Meister. Right. I'm just, you know.
Yeah, that's your day job.
So that's the other thing. So I do that, and I run around with him, and no one wants to talk about the clerk of court. No one wants to talk about politics. If they do, they do want to talk about not Foxy Kim, but Kim Fox and Jesse Smollett and all the controversies that other race that's going on. So I got frustrated. And then another candidate for judge was talking about an effort that I heard of in Minnesota. It was like, drag him to vote, do this. I said, drag him. And it just occurred to me, drag them to the polls is literally you want to try to get people to vote. Mm-hmm. Also, he was just using the term. He didn't even think about, well, no, it has to be a drag show. We sell them. They come out for a drag show. And this is happening right around when RuPaul's Drag Race is doing red, white, and blue colors and talking mm-hmm. about having people, you know, I can't remember the exact play on words, but it's a political theme mm-hmm. with this premiere on Friday.
It is, yeah.
And it just occurred to me, okay, that's a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Let's drag them in for an hour-long viewing. Every single gay bar, let's back up a bit, in Boys Town, gay bars that only do pool and sports and football and basketball will have RuPaul's Drag Race on this Friday. Guess why? They can make money. Mm-hmm. All the bars will fill up. Some of the straight bars, like Town Hall Pub or something that are in the area, will fill up because there's just no other places. And so to have this room that wasn't even going to be open be available for people to come in and watch their favorite show. And then, afterwards, we're going to have some drag performers. Yeah. And in between the drag Great performers, time. Yeah. we're going to talk about the election.
There you go.
So that's the plan is to and not let them talk as long as I just did about it. Not let them be that boring. Right. Cut him short.
Organizer Richard Streetman is here as well as Foxy Kim, and we're talking about the Drag Them to the Polls initiative. It's a show that starts at Hamburger Mary's on Friday, really to watch the premiere of RuPaul's Drag Race and then do a show and talk politics. But then it's also, and we'll take a break here, but we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the initiative. It's not just about the show that's on Friday. It's about trying to engage with the gay community to get them to vote in 2020. Richard Streetman and Foxy Kim in studio. Stay with us. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Richard Streetman and Foxy Kim. And they're talking about their big show, which is going to be at Hamburger Mary's up in Andersonville. It's called Drag Them to the Polls. It'll be a half watching RuPaul's Drag Race and then half a drag show and little politics talk in the middle of it. Richard is the organizer, and Foxy Kim will be performing at the event. RuPaul's Drag Race. Mm-hmm. This has become the meteoric rise. It's unbelievable to think it's a 12th season, but this is a show where RuPaul was hosting Saturday Night Live just not too long ago. It's become a household name. Are you surprised as a drag performer at how drag, because of this show, is becoming more mainstream?
I don't think I'm surprised at all. Rue is very good at taking something subversive and turning it around and flipping it on its head and making it you know, super appealing to the masses. It's on VH1. That's never in my wildest dreams would I think we would get on VH1, but you know, she's very good at that.
Right.
You know, but in RuPaul's own history, because RuPaul had the RuPaul show on VH1 25 years ago, perhaps, in that era, and that was a high point of you know, supermodel on drag was really cool for a moment, and then it was not for 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. So I know that she's probably counting all of her coins and keeping all of her money and waiting for any moment where the worm turns and there's another, you know, sense of...
I mean, she's also a very... I don't want to, like, put her on a pedestal. She's a very controversial figure in the drag community because of some of her anti-trans standpoints and anti-AFAB, so assigned female at birth queens. So currently, you know, none of those types of folks are allowed on the show. So she can get a little bit controversial. And it's because of her sort of high curation and sort of what is really good for TV, quote unquote, right? That she is so good at making this, you know,
she's marketed a personality.
To,
exactly. Unbelievable personality.
Marketed to the masses.
The drag show, though, like beyond RuPaul's show, the drag show happening in Boys Town or other places in Chicago, I feel has had a resurgence to the point where I would think they're pretty popular right now. I can't tell you how many times I'm invited to a drag show. And to live in Chicago as long as I have, they've been around. But it seems like maybe it's because of RuPaul, maybe it's becoming more mainstream, that there seems to be more of a straight audience for drag shows than maybe there were before.
Yeah, so we are in a golden age of drag right now, and I'm not kidding myself, right? So I definitely recognize it that the market is super saturated. There are tons of shows everywhere you look, but also there are tons of audience members. And it's a super straight, diverse, you know, maybe mixed audience that we didn't have 5 or 6 years ago when I started. It was a lot more niche and a lot closed off, but now it's open to everyone. My godmother watches it, and she goes, "I watch the RuPauls, you know," and she points at them. And I'm like, "All right, cool."
Well, thanks. The stigma's gone, so that's good. If you're like if you're doing a more transgressive, queer kind of drag, but it's also good if you're a straight woman doing drag, because there's straight women doing drag, which is just basically taking their cisgender straightness, their normal, like, oh, when I say normal, so wrong actually. Yeah. They're cisgendered, meaning, for those who don't know the term, you know, there was a period where there were men and there were women, and that's all assigned at birth, and we put everyone in that box, and to be outside of that box was transgressive. And so people who were born as assigned by society as female, who present as female, and then do drag, you wouldn't maybe necessarily have thought that as drag, but it is, maybe it's transgressive in its own way, you know, that it's I'm taking this thing that I wasn't allowed to do. Because there was a moment where, and probably there still are many performers, that find that controversial.
I feel like we live in a bubble in Chicago, and we think, oh yeah, of course, anyone can do drag. And yes, anyone can do drag. Drag is about using gender as your expression and your art. It has nothing to do with what your gender necessarily is, right? But if we go out of Chicago, we have to remind ourselves, like, outside of Chicago, there's a lot of anti- AFAB and trans sentiment toward who can do drag. And I'm constantly reminding myself, right, that the fight is not over just for that. And that's just who can do drag, right? That's just the gatekeeping around drag.
I was going to say, you don't think of drag and the drag community as political. There are a lot of still issues that they're working through, that you're working through, that when you come to uniting one community.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And so... It's so amazing because queer people have such amazing ideas and voices, and I feel like they're not being heard. Sometimes I feel like they're just in an echo chamber, and I how to break out of that, right? And so kind of going back to your event, I think that's why it's really important that more queer people are engaged politically. They are voting, they are registering to vote, and they're encouraging their friends to. And you don't have to agree with me or what I'm voting for, but just do it. Your ideas are interesting and good, and they need to be heard.
That's Foxy Kim, a drag performer who will be on stage at Hamburger Mary's in Chicago's Andersonville neighborhood for Drag Them to the Polls, which will feature members of the drag community performing and also raising awareness for the Illinois primary while watching, of course, the season premiere of the 12th season of RuPaul's Drag Race. Richard Streetman's the organizer. The gay community has been well known in the Illinois area as being pretty political. Some of the players have flexed muscle and been able to pass things like gay marriage.
Our majority leader is Greg Harris right now. So
right now, Greg Harris, of course, in Chicago, you have the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, there's that too.
How politically motivated and activated is the gay community? You'll have the leaders who are obviously in big, powerful positions, but people who are just part of the community, who are in the LGBTQ community, are they actively participating in elections?
Well, similar to the drag, you know, performance world, the, we'll just say queer, LGBTQ political world, even looking solely at elected officials or people running, there's such a diversity now, and it's, we're victims of our success, that we're not unified. There would have been a time when Tom Keol, I believe it was 1994, was the first openly gay elected official in the entire state of Illinois. He ran for Cook County judge countywide against kind of what the Cook County Democratic Party, or at least the sub-circuit, was doing. And he won. And then you started seeing judges and more people. Tom Tunney, who was my landlord until he sold my building to the Glass Gods. Okay. I went from paying my rent to the restaurant below me to paying my rent at a bar around the corner. Was the first openly gay alderman. Now we have several. We have committeemen, and we have, I mean, we just have an abundance of riches.
But you're right.
But they don't all belong to the same club.
Right.
You have Democratic Socialists on one hand, and you have people like Greg, who is doing a great job, but he is there because Speaker Madigan put him there. So his political leaning and his alliances and the decisions he makes on who to support, he doesn't automatically support the openly gay candidates. He supports the candidates that align with his interests.
I'll ask the question I think that a lot of people are probably asking is, does the gay community unified and commit to someone like Mayor Pete? As an openly gay
candidate? No, absolutely not. No. Because so many young gays, emphatically no. Like, I've been supporting him on my own, and that's, but I'm also fine, honestly, with any, this is not to do with dragging me to the polls. My personal thing is I'll vote for any Democrat. Honestly.
Okay.
No hesitation.
But the gay community, it's not identity politics anymore.
At all, if you were to scroll through my face, you know, if you were to scroll through Foxy's Facebook feed, there's a sharp divide for Mayor Pete right now.
Yeah.
And I would say, lots of gay people, especially what I would call queer people, are really not in support of him. And it's really interesting to see how that's sort of manifesting in, you know, sort of two very distinct sides within a single community.
And older white gay men like me, I'm not, I mean, I'm over 29 now by about a week. A lot of us did do identity politics and support Pete. And frankly, some, not myself, have fairly moderate politics. And so that fits more than, say, a Bernie Sanders. But younger gay people are not even interested in, you know, the fact that he's a cisgender white gay man. They'd rather have the elderly but fairly left, you know, candidate Bernie Sanders, who is in their values, than have the person who shares a sexuality with them.
Well, I mean, that's how we vote, right? We vote on the values and who's going to be most like-minded. But identity politics has been a huge part of the gay community for years. You just mentioned it was Tom Keol. This idea that there used to be a push in saying, you know, we're behind,
all stuck together.
But because now
we're too successful to stick. Now we're not sticking together as the elect people because of identity politics, it gets a bad rap. Mm-hmm. Identity politics is also about power, though. I mean, the African-American community does not debate itself on, well, we can't just support this candidate because they're the only African-American. They say, look, whether we agree 100% or not, we got to get behind one of our own.
Right.
A lot of times.
I think it's good. Identity politics are one thing, but really I think it's accountability, right? So we are now at a place in our lives, which I think is great, that we can actually hold candidates accountable for their actions and for their views rather than worried about, you know, what their sexuality is.
Right.
And so that to me is a
good
thing. Or
their color of their skin. Right. Or anything about them,
right? We can actually look at what they represent and what they are representing for us. And that level of accountability is so much better. And I'm glad we're at a place where we can actually do that.
Richard, what's the plan after the show? Because the show's on Friday, but this is really about all year long to try and make Drag Them to the Polls a civic-minded movement as opposed to just a show.
Well, this is the plan. If you can hear my voice right now out there in the world, first of all, Dr. Foxy Kim and I are in full drag. Yes. And let me just say that Dr. Foxy Kim has a drag face for radio.
Yes.
She's perfect for radio. It looks great.
And a drag voice for it, too.
But that being said, it's up to you to show up at Friday to express some interest, because if this goes well Friday, if we get a good response and everybody, you know, learns something, enjoys the show, we'll probably do it for the next three Fridays. I do want to make one correction. It's a Don't go to Hamburger Mayor's. Go to Mayor's Attic, which is the same building, but it's the second floor.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Hamburger,
about that.
No, that's fine. That's Hamburger Mayor's Chicago is one, is the restaurant. Mayor's right. Attic is just the above space it. Above it.
Right.
But no, it's the same business. Yeah. It's just, you know, you might get a little confused when you're eating burgers instead of watching RuPaul's Drag Race. And they have a drag show at the same time, so it will be even further confusing.
Yeah, that is confusing.
There's drag drag everywhere.
Right, right.
It's everywhere.
But that one comes with a side of mayonnaise and some fries. Seasoned. They were quite delicious.
Richard, we'll wrap up here, but for you, this is a big week with C2E2 in town for cosplay for you, Foxy. And with this, of course, I mean, are you gigging all the time? Is it now at the point where every weekend we can see Foxy Kim on stage somewhere?
Yeah, I have a day job that has nothing to do with any of this. And I also travel for that. So my schedule is like a jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. I was just talking about that with someone. And so you can catch me. Yeah. So I do C2E2 gigs. So I'll be at Berlin for Geek House. And then Saturday I'll be at the Ritz-Carlton for the Smile Bright after party. So I'll be there. Sunday I'm off, and then next week I'll be at the Intercontinental doing my Poor Decisions show. That's on the 15th.
Well, downtown hotels,
downtown at the Magma.
Every night's my Poor Decisions show.
It's my schedule. Oh, and then I'll actually be at Hamburger Mary's on the 7th on a Saturday well. So I'm all over the place.
Right.
My schedule is crazy.
Great. Well, thanks for coming in. Foxy Kim, a drag performer in Chicago, and Richard Streetman, an organizer of the show Drag Them to the Polls, which will be at Mary's Attic above Hamburger Mary's in Chicago's Andersonville neighborhood on Friday night. When's it start?
The show is, meaning the TV show, 7 to 8. The drag show mixture meet and greet will be from 8 to about 9:30.
Okay.
And I just want to thank Jackie Supergirl Weinberg for doing our logo for free. And also say WGN Morning News, call us. We'd love to be on camera. We'd love to show you our drag face, not just
the
radio.
The show, of course, is on Friday, and it'll also feature the season premiere of RuPaul's Drag Race. Foxy Kim, Richard, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Doctor, let's go get some White Claw and Taco Bell.
Okay, sounds good. And I want to meet Kim Fox.
312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman with you here in 720 WGN. It's fun to have Foxy Kim, which is amazing. What a great drag name that has nothing to do with Kim Fox. You're a Chicago drag performer in Foxy Kim, and you actually had that name before Kim Fox even got into politics. With Goldmine, right? Pretty great. Yeah, go check that out. And it is true. Oh, man, we talked about it for a half hour, but it is incredible to think about how successful and mainstream RuPaul's Drag Race is. Show which is season premiere will be Friday night on VH1. But, I mean, to the point where RuPaul is now a household name, hosting Saturday Night Live. And we would never think that a drag show that would be on TV would be able to win over the masses like that. But it is. The Texters Tonight's in my favorite show. I watch it every 12 seasons. I mean, not a lot of shows can say they went 12 seasons. But yeah, and many times over when you think about, even when Foxy Kim was listing off the places that he's performing, the Intercontinental, the Ritz-Carlton, different places in Boys Town. It's not just relegated to one block of Halstead anymore.
That's cool.
And I loved it. I think that that's so telling. I think that because we have to cover politics in such big swaths, right? Everything's about big paint strokes, that you just automatically believe that the gay community is for the gay candidate, Pete Buttigieg, right? Everybody just believes, well, he'll get the gay vote. To hear here today, that's not the case. And that's not how it's lining up, which may be a trouble spot for Mayor Pete. Speaking of mayors, that's what I want to talk about. I, last night, caught the interview that Trevor Noah did with our former mayor, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Rahm's on a book tour. This is his second life now. He wrote a book called The Nation's City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. And he's hit the Eastern Seaboard, right? Mostly the Sunday morning programs out of D.C. and New York. Now the evening programs like The Daily Show, and he was on The View this week. saying some garbage talk about how they have to do everything they possibly can to stop Bernie Sanders, which is ridiculous that a Democrat would say that to a Democrat. And you would not accept, if you're a Republican, you would not accept that for a Republican to say that to a Republican. It's just surprising how much vitriol there is for Bernie. But I digress. The interview was interesting because Trevor Noah did a great job. I don't know if he's got Chicago writers or Chicago people, but he really represented the dissenting opinion on Mayor Emanuel's tenure. If you look back on the two terms that the mayor served, you recognize that it was kind of a mixed bag. There are clear signs that the downtown area of Chicago has developed and evolved into one of the bright shining, I would say, downtowns in America. But you would also have to recognize that the haves and the have-nots separated, many people leaving Chicago, record number of public schools closed in that sweeping move in the early, was 2011, 2012. The Laquan McDonald murder, and some of the biggest property tax increases in the history of the city. And so it's a mixed bag. And I thought Trevor Noah did a really great job last night. And it made me think about the show tonight to be like, well, maybe that's a good conversation to see how people truly feel about Rahm Emanuel. Because Trevor Noah is like, you're not that popular. Studios called it out, saying, and because he was talking about his book, in his book he was saying that the idea of mayors are going to run the world because mayors have to deal with so much and they have to be pragmatic and they have to be centrist and they have to get things done. But in the book, he actually shows some, I don't know if remorse is the right word, but he at least shows that he failed in some cases and he underestimated or misunderstood some of the other issues that Chicago was facing. And Trevor Noah jumped on that. So that's the question I ask you tonight, 312-981-7200. Do you look back at the mayor who is really touting how great he was on this tour as a good Chicago mayor? Do you agree with the idea that mayors run the world? I'm not sure I buy that. Remember when it used to be we'd have a mayor in Chicago and Mayor Daley who didn't want to get caught up in national politics? That all politics is local was good enough for them? Well, in this book, it's almost the other. It's all politics is local. That's why they would make great presidents. I'm not sure I buy it. But in the interview, which is kind of, I think I was trying to encapsulate why Chicagoans have a frigid reaction to Mayor Emanuel. When asked pointed questions about tough things, whether it be closing schools or Laquan McDonald, the mayor went out of his way to go into the positive accomplishments of his tenure. So one, universal pre-K, the idea of community colleges and being free to anyone from city with the B average. Nobody asked you that. it feels like that's the problem with Rahm Emanuel, is that, especially on his book tour right now, is that he wants to come across as this wise, chiseled veteran of politics. And because he was a mayor, he understands the world in the right way. He can give you insight to what was happening in 2020 because he's had time to reflect. But then he gets into the interview and he goes right into campaign mode and starts touting his accomplishments as if we were interested in his accomplishments. That's not what he was selling to us. He was selling us some idea of he's got some wisdom he can shed. But instead he'd be like, so what's the meaning of the world, Mr. Mayor? Well, before I get to that, universal pre-K and community colleges, and we had a graduation rate that was bad. Hold for applause. Nobody asked you that. And I get it that everyone wants to concentrate on the negative, But it's not even about that. You want to get past. You want to find something that he's going to, from his time in public service, he's going to have nuggets that will help us better understand the city we live in and the way we live, regardless of where we are. This guy, that's what he's writing. The name of it is The Nation City, Why Mayors Are Now Running the World. All right. I don't need your resume. And I think that's what always gets me, because he, when we used to interview him, he would come in, was it once a month or so, on Cochran Show back in the day when I was on the show with him. And you'd sit there across, and that's what it was. It was 15, knew how long the time was, 15 minutes, and it was 14 minutes of let me tout accomplishment and the vegetables I grew in my garden. And you're like, wait, what Laquan McDonald, can we talk? What? You just filibuster, you wouldn't get a chance to talk to him about it. But I wonder, because I look at it and I still believe that Rahm Emanuel has clout and power when it comes to national politics. And there's part of me that still can't put my finger on why he was so disliked. Trevor Noah called him the 1% mayor last night. So that's what the knock on Emanuel is. Then he's, well, universal pre-K. Well, let me finish. Let me up community college B student. It's the same thing. But what is it? What is it about Rahm Emanuel that Chicago just won't embrace? Or are you embracing him and it's just the loudmouths? The people who didn't like Rahm Emanuel to begin with that are just hogging the stage. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Get some texts coming in on this. We'll get to it in just a second. We'll take a break. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. 312-981-7200. Phone number. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN till 11 o'clock. Earlier in the show, we talked about the coronavirus and whether or not the president's press conference today was enough for you to be secure in the fact that the White House and the administration is taking this seriously and protecting us as American citizens. And we also talked a little bit about affordable housing around Jackson Park and the Obama Library, which was very interesting because the mayor has put forth a plan in Chicago to protect affordable housing, to create and protect it, to keep people who can't afford development or gentrification in the neighborhood. And the bigger question was just, is that legal, A, or B, can you just let the market do what the market does? That's the American way. Why should the government get involved with saying how much a piece of property is? The Obama administration, or not the Obama administration, the Obama Center, the foundation, moved into Jackson Park and city of Chicago under Rahm Emanuel, let them. If developers want to build fancy new condos near there and the market bears it, why should they not be able to? Then we talked public education. We had some drag queens on. It's been quite a show. 773 says, I'm a veteran CPS teacher, a proud Chicago resident. And according, when it comes to Rahm Emanuel, his arrogance always annoyed me. And that was before I began to despise him for closing schools and the teacher strike. Teacher strike is an interesting one. And it's kind of interesting because the teacher strike that Mayor Emanuel was at the helm of will probably be remembered more than the one that Mayor Lightfoot was at the helm of. Maybe because of the viciousness of Mayor Emanuel and Karen Lewis at the time. I don't know. But it does feel that way, doesn't it? Christine says, Rahm could not tolerate stupid people, and we are all stupid. I agree, as a fellow stupid person. He was chief of staff in the White House for a reason. He would get stuff done, was the president's bulldog, He didn't have to care. That's ill-suited to being customer-facing in the role of mayor. I think that's true. The bedside manner. How do you talk to the people of Chicago? Christine believes he talked down to us. Rahm wanted to be another Michael Bloomberg, says 312. Bloomberg has the money and can throw his weight around. Rahm doesn't have the wealth, although he certainly had the ego. Yeah. That is true. When it comes to whether or not you believe that the country is protected or doing, at least the administration is doing what they can to protect us from coronavirus, Christine says if people are worried about this but haven't had a flu shot, they need to consider their priorities. That's true, right? That is absolutely true. 219 says Indiana ranks 40th in the nation in healthcare. What does Mike Pence bring to the table? There's a lot that was made of the decision to put the vice president in charge of, I guess, coordination when it comes to battling coronavirus. The president's announced that in the press conference today. Twitter critics responded quickly that the vice president has not had a great track record when it comes to public health. He's on the record in different places. There's one point where he says something goofy about smoking cigarettes and it doesn't kill you. There's a video that cropped up from as early or as late as 2000 making that assertion. And then the story, which I think is one that a lot of people are questioning why he's involved in that, because there was the famed, and I think it was as early as late as 2015, there was the famed HIV outbreak in Indiana when he was governor. He had cut funding for public health. He had cut funding for HIV awareness and HIV funding in general. And we hadn't seen HIV outbreaks in this country. It was under control. And there was a small area of Indiana that had an outbreak. And it really was brought up and kind of exposed, no pun intended, but exposed during the run for president. When your running mate is president, is Donald J. Trump, there's not that much that's going to stick to you about things you did wrong because everyone's just paying attention to Trump. But that was an issue in the campaign in 2016 because that was, you could draw a straight line to the fact that the governor at the time, Governor Pence, didn't seem to want to fund those things and didn't find any, I guess you would say, value in creating defense mechanisms or public health initiatives. And instead, what we saw was an HIV outbreak in 2015. That's not normal. He didn't do a good job in 1988. We all go, yeah, well, that was universal. But 2015, the government does have some responsibility when it comes to public health. And people will point to the state of Indiana under his tenure and his administration saying he wasn't funding it. So that's why you're getting some head scratching tonight. And people are texting in now saying the same thing of putting him in charge of a public health crisis. There's a lot of people you can say, my health and human services guy is going to be run point, right? I would even expect Rick Perry, come on down. You're in, right? Is Scott Pruitt still in my cabinet? Come on down. You're in. I'll even bring Jeff Sessions back. Where's Jeff? You and the guy from Dancing with the Stars, used to be my press secretary, you two are in charge of coronavirus. We'll probably get a better reaction from Twitter than the vice president. 773 says, I didn't like Rahm at the start, but I came to like him very much. We're still benefiting from his work on climate. He's very proactive. That's a good point. The one thing I will say in defense and support of the vice president is, in his words, I don't know what's going to happen actually in his actions, but his words today at the press conference were pretty authoritative and pretty assuring. I was impressed with his presentation because I felt like he took it seriously and he approached it pragmatic, and he told us what they were going to do and how they were going to do it and what to be aware of, and they kind of went down the road. So I felt like, not knowing anything about what he had done in the past in the state of Indiana, or just knowing it, you know, like everybody else, just from kind of remembering it from the campaign in 2016 or living in this area in 2015. So I was impressed that the way he kind of took that on. But reading tonight, just some of the things that went wrong in the state of Indiana and his personal opinions on some public health crisis, there is a question. You start to wonder if he's the right guy. Not questioning his competence and whatever, but there's a lot of it. Politics is about how it looks, and so never great to have that be the kickoff of a public health campaign, especially when it comes to something as serious as coronavirus. 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm is coming up next for the final swap meet. Just entered the building. We just saw him through the window. Greg Flamm, of course, has been doing the swap meet with me for 4 years. DuPage Picker, you have memorabilia, you have collectibles, you have junk. Greg will evaluate it for you, find out if it's worth anything, and whether you should keep it. Well, Greg let us know this week that he is leaving, he is moving out of state. He didn't say why, I think it's something with the law. No, that's not the case. But tonight will be the last swap meet, which is a bummer. But that will be coming up right after the news here, 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm and the swap meet, the final swap meet. So stay with us. There's that music, and that music says it's time for the swap meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and DuPage Picker himself, Greg Flamm, is in the building. This segment we've been doing since 2016. Evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, and your junk. The best junk usually wins a prize. We can do a prize tonight. But the prize for us is that we've had 4 great years of doing this segment with Greg Flamm, a picker in the area who is a listener. The origins of this bit was just you listening, and we started talking about it, and the next thing you know, you're in studio with us.
Yeah, you know, you were talking with P. I remember it clearly, and you went back and forth, and like, we need to do a show called Swap Meet, where one guy calls in with something and 5 people want to trade him for. And I'm thinking, right. Oh, that's cute, you know. And I'm listing on eBay, so you know, to the eBayers out there, listing will get you a radio segment, and. And then you came back from the break and you were still talking about it. I'm like, okay, now I got to text in some pictures. And I brought a couple of the items that actually got me the gig. And so it's kind of cool. We'll
it's
talk
great.
About that.
And Greg, as we've brought this to you, you know, weekly for 4 years, and Greg is making the decision to leave and move out of state. What has happened? So what's happening here?
So I'm going to the Naperville of Vegas, which is Henderson. and it's been a lifelong dream to live out there. I had the pleasure of living outside of Phoenix for 3 years, and I love the Southwest, just the scenery and 360 days of average sunlight and everything like that. So that's always been the dream to go back. And so I've been working on it for the last 3 years to head back, and it just kind of fell together like in the last 2 weeks where it financially made great sense to do it. So I'm heading out hopefully late this weekend, maybe next week, and hoping to catch some spring training games, and it should be a lot of fun. Yeah. I'll obviously do picking out there and just continue what I do. I can do this anywhere, and I have literally a 9-foot by 6-by-8 pod of back stock, you know, so I'm not at any loss for inventory, that's for sure. So, and I'll find it more out there as well.
There you go. Well, this segment has been so much fun, and tonight's our final episode. And so you brought in some of the stuff for the first episode.
Yeah.
You still have it. That's awesome. What do you have here?
I'm giving this to you and Pete.
No way.
You guys get to keep this. And the first two items ever kind of got the ball rolling was the Jane Byrne coloring book. Which is not only Jane Byrne's on the color, but it's probably something they gave out at like Chicago Fest or something. But I mean, not only that, you got like Steve Dahl and Mike Royko and Richard Daly in here and uncolored, like brand new. So that's kind of cool. And then the halftime flag.
That's my favorite item by
all
far.
This is really a rare find. It is the halftime flag for Super Bowl 20. and it had instructions on it of when to wave it. And oddly enough, the halftime act was up with people.
Right.
So, I mean, that just takes you way
back.
Look
at the yellow flag.
And it's got the yellow flag. It's got the instructions printed on it when to wave it so you can, you know, they can color scheme the whole stadium.
Up with people. Yeah. Yellow. Go yellow.
Yeah. So
Red's turn. Blue's turn.
Yeah, so that's really kind of a prize. And then, of course, I brought one of the three iconic Super Bowl 20 posters.
Yeah, this is it, man. This is the one.
Yeah, this is one of three that are just iconic. The other one, this is horizontal. The other one's vertical. I think the other two are vertical.
This is amazing because this is, of course, the different scenes from the Super Bowl
collage thing.
Of course, and Danimal with the big sack and the touchdowns and a kind of disappointed Walter Payton.
Bob Costas.
A Bob Costas interview and Ditka after Super Bowl. This is the classic poster.
It is. So I'm hoping you guys can find a good spot for it.
We appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been a thrill, and I couldn't even ask for 4 years, let alone one time or two times on, and just to come in here and you guys do all the work, and I just come in here and spew out some numbers.
They're calling and texting for you tonight. A lot of great. It's a half and half. Half the texts are people with stuff they want evaluated. Mm-hmm. The other half is farewells, and then there's an other one saying who can replace Greg, saying I also do this, and so there's a little bit of that. Let's go to the phones right away. Let's go to Steve. Steve, welcome to the Swap Meet. What do you want to brag about, buddy?
I got three toys from 1978. Two are Star Wars. One is a figure. It's a blue Snaggletooth.
Okay.
And the other toy from that same year is the Sonic Land Speeder. It's the one where you put batteries in it and it runs around and stuff.
That's the best.
I'm assuming they're all Kenner. That's who made the early Star Wars toys. And
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and some of those are just crazy. It obviously, condition is everything.
They're still got the boxes. Are still in the
packages. Oh, man, if you have the boxes, I mean, I can't even imagine. I've seen some go for over 1,000, I can tell you that.
I've never seen that. I've seen the speeder that doesn't have the batteries in it, and I always mention it to people and say, I think you're mistaken. They didn't make anything like that with batteries, but I got one.
Yeah, and you see the Kenner like molded stamp on the bottom of the that's on there. Okay, I mean, I've never seen
those
one in person,
golden,
but
those
yeah,
are the Holy Grail.
That is the golden era too of Star Wars toys. That whole Kenner late 70s.
I had the speeder, Steve, and
What did you do with it? You melted it with
yeah. I think I maybe put a firecracker in it and ruined it, and it's slightly used. It's slightly.
But you had fun with it.
I had fun with it. Right. Thanks for calling, man. Yeah,
sure. What about the blue Snaggletooth? The same thing?
You know, I don't have that offhand. If you want to write me at Facebook, DuPage Picker, or Instagram, I'll be happy to look that up and get a clearer.
Do you have a number I can call you at instead?
If you just message me on that, I'll give you my number. How's that?
Okay.
So I love it. Thanks, Steve. I love that the last swap meet, someone's like, can I get your number?
Right.
I've been doing this for 4 years. No
one's
ever
asked.
It's
a long drive out to Vegas.
630 says, I love the swap meet guy. Going to miss him for real.
Thank you.
There's such great stuff. Best wishes to Greg. And there's also, let's get into some of the things people are putting through tonight. Three newspapers with impeached headlines. Nixon, the Chicago Daily News for Clinton, St. Petersburg Time for Trump, the Tampa Bay Times. What do you think about impeached headlines, newspapers?
That's interesting because individually they're probably not worth that much, probably like maybe $10 to $20 each. But if you put them in a bundle like that, you might get better value, maybe $50 to $100. And it's definitely something you want to do in auction because unless, when you do comps, if you're seeing other people have thought of the same idea, but chances are you'll be the only one with three or four of the newspapers with impeachment.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. 708 says, I have two bobbleheads, one Notre Dame, golden green, two Bears, blue and orange. They appear to be made in the 50s or 60s, maybe earlier. Really?
Yeah, the vintage bobbleheads, those are gold. I know the Notre Dame one.
I didn't know they did. I thought they made those like when Urlacher was playing.
Yeah, I'm kicking myself because I had a lot of the White Sox early bobbleheads, and I don't know what happened to them, but I'm kicking myself. But yeah, I know the Notre Dame one could go for upwards of like $200. I would think the Bears one would probably be in the same, because it's that same era. Right. It'd be in that same area.
Wow. And that's those are the ones that are made by with lead. Right? Right. Those are the ones you don't right. want to lick, right?
But and they're so delicate. I mean, I've seen them in person, and a lot of times they're chipped or something because they're just not made to last right. forever.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. I got Matt, I got Dave, I got people calling in, I got some great texters on the line, all saying goodbye to Greg as well, as this is his last swap meet before he moves out to Nevada, Henderson, Nevada. It's been a great four-year run, but we still, if you still got stuff you want evaluated, like Matt, like Dave, and people who are texting in, we still got a good 45 minutes with Greg, so let's use it. Stay with us. 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman with you. It's a swap meet. Of course, Greg Flamm, at DuPage Picker, has been the heart and soul of the swap meet, and he has announced tonight that he is leaving the state. He's moving to Henderson, Nevada. Tonight will be his final swap meet. We started this thing in May of 2016. Saw us, we look like babies. First picture, we're just like,
well, maybe I did.
and now tonight, we end it. It's been a great run, a four-year run. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Matt. Matt's standing by. Matt, what do you want to brag about, bud?
You can't leave. Oh, God.
You can. Everyone can still message me at DuPage Picker. I'll gladly answer any questions you have. And
well, that's good to know.
I'll try to stop by throughout the summer. Hopefully, we can reunite at some point.
Before I talk G.I. Joe with you, I'd just like to point out my most memorable Greg moment is when you talked about the mummified cat.
Somebody had that. I didn't have that, that's for sure. That was interesting. I don't know if they won the pizza that night or not, but that was interesting. One of my favorite moments was the woman that had, so hold on, she's climbing up a ladder going up to, and that was one of mine, yeah.
She was climbing up the ladder to her attic while she was on the phone.
To look at, like, silver dollars.
You could hear her breathing. She was, like, going to fall down, and we're like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, what do you got?
I have a Snake Eyes from the 80s. It's G.I. Joe. I still have all his little weapons. I have the wolf that I can't remember the name of at the moment. It's not carded, but I do have all of its pieces. What am I looking at, Greg?
If it was on the backing board, I've seen some of the figures alone on backing board go for more than $800.
What?
But you still have a lot of the small pieces, which I think will help.
These are
just the little guys or the big guys?
Yeah, they're smaller
the
ones.
I had those guys.
Yeah, they're on the backing board.
Darn
and
it.
I've seen, let's see, there's a lot where it's like multiple figures and multiple small pieces for over $1,000 easily. So hopefully you got a lot of small pieces and, you know, you
I feel like Destro. You got Destro?
Right. I don't know how to see that one.
Matt, do you have Zartan?
I have Destro, I have Zartan, and I have one pink Cobra guy that I can't think of.
Yeah,
do you have the G.I. Joe's like Shipwreck? Remember he came with a parrot?
I do not have Shipwreck, unfortunately.
Nice.
So,
but yeah, I mean,
this is where Justin has too much fun.
This is what I love it. And I do this all night.
Those small pieces, I mean, I love that stuff. And I'll give you a hint to other new pickers out there. When you go to an estate sale, hit the toy box and go to dive to the bottom of that toy box, and that's where you're going to find those small little G.I. Joe pieces.
Yeah.
They're loose. They're just tucked in the corner at the bottom of a toy box. So that's where you'll find that stuff. And some of those, just a small gun or a holster, you might get $30, $40 just for that one little tiny piece.
Wow. There you go. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for calling in, buddy.
Much love, Greg.
Thank you so much.
Much love, Greg. Good luck, and enjoy gambling.
Oh, yeah.
There he goes.
Not why I'm going there, but that's cool. Thanks.
All right, let's go to Dave. Dave, welcome to the swap meet. What do you want to brag about?
I got in the box still a toy that my kids had way, way back. It was called the Mr. Machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the clear casing on the outside, and it winds up, and it goes along and whistles, and you see all the wheels going inside of it.
Yep, I know. Was
anything?
Oh, sure. You still have the box, you say?
Yes.
What is this thing? What is it, Mr. Machine?
It was like it was like almost a 2D type robot. It didn't, it's kind of a flat plastic, and you see some of the gears moving, and it would just basically, I think if I'm not mistaken, you could draw a line and it would follow it on a piece of paper on the ground. Regardless, if you have the box, they go upwards of $150.
Wow!
And if it's a great condition box, you might get more than that.
Jeez, how about that? Tonight's the
okay. Where would I go for that?
Yeah, if you know someone who does eBay or. If I was staying in town, I would I help you, you know, I do consignment. But, yeah, I just try to find a family member maybe that can help you list
it. There you go. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. Let's keep going. Let's go to John standing by. John, what do you want to brag about, John?
Hi. I have a Kenner Light Beam car, a Dodge Charger, red. It's in the box. Only thing is, it's photo cell driven, obviously, because it's a Light Beam car. It doesn't work. But it looks absolutely pristine. I mean, it could be the switch underneath that's bad. I never open it up to mess with it.
Very so it's nice. Like a what? How big is this car?
It's like about a foot, maybe 10 inches a foot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was made by Kenner. I think they made a Mustang version, too.
Okay, right.
This was a Dodge Charger. I want to say it was 1970 or 69.
Right, and there's quite a few, unfortunately, on eBay. They do go for about $50 to $100, depending on condition. Mm-hmm. You might get a little bit more for it. I definitely do an auction, but yeah. I do see quite a few that have sold in the past.
All right, there you go.
Hey, can I throw one more thing
sure.
at you?
Go ahead.
I also had a car called Johnny Speed that was probably 5 years older than that.
Okay.
And it was a large version of a Jaguar with a cable on it, and you carried around the controller. And it had a lantern battery in it.
Oh, wow.
I got it when I was like 5 years old. I remember trying to carry this thing, trying to get the thing to run. It still runs.
That's
I've
wild.
Got the, it's in the box and everything.
That's
I think that was made by Ideal Toys.
Yeah, I love the Ideal Toys. That was all like mid to late 70s. Ideal is awesome.
Awesome.
I can't find that one offhand.
Yeah. He doesn't have it anymore anyway.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could give you a price offhand.
All right, let's try Elaine. Elaine, what do you want to brag about, Elaine?
I have Smokey the Bear. It was bought as a souvenir, actually. It was left to me. Well, it was my mom's, and it is a Smokey the Bear. He is plastic. His arms and head move. He's wearing a hat. He's got on a pair of pants and a belt that says Smokey. He's holding a shovel that
nice.
Says prevent forest fires.
Right.
And I have a tag on him that says R. Dakin and Company.
Yeah, Dakin.
San
yeah.
Francisco, blah, blah, Smokey Bear.
That's awesome you still have the tag on that because as old as it is, a lot of those tags either fade or they just got torn off.
So he's in great. His original package.
Yeah, that's great. I'm narrowing it down right now as we speak.
It doesn't, you don't pull a string, it goes, do you can prevent
No,
fires?
Uh-uh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I would, I'd take that
His
off your hands right
now. His little
shovel
says prevent forest
yeah,
fires.
Right.
Yeah, they're looking like about $50 to $100, and definitely do an auction if you do sell it.
There you go.
Okay.
That's pretty good. I like
that. Oh, can I ask you one more
sure,
thing?
Go ahead.
I've got a Singer sewing machine made for a kid.
Okay.
It's about 67 years old. It came with a bracket that you, like, clasp to the table, a C-clamp.
Okay.
And it's workable. The handle turns, the needles goes up and down, and it actually works. And back in the day, that was used to make, sold to make clothes for something called a Ginny doll.
Yes. I found a few of them on here. They do go for about between $100 to $200, depending how complete they are, if they still work. So on and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, even having the instruction manual for it will help get a few more dollars.
I do.
Yeah, that's great.
I even have the original little suitcase
nice.
That it came in. Okay,
very
thank
cool.
you
no
so
problem.
Much. We're going to miss you.
Thank you
Thanks,
so much.
Elaine. Thanks for calling in. Oh.
That's my mom's name, so I got to love it.
773 says, my most memorable swap meet was a lady who called in with a VHS tape of a Cubs convention on a boat. And she had, yeah, I remember. She had a VHS tape of her, some of the players in the hot tub, and she wanted to know if it was worth it.
Right. Yep. Hard to evaluate that. Yeah, some good ones.
That was a pretty good one.
Yep.
I don't know if it's worth anything. It's definitely worth maybe throwing a party and
right.
putting it on. But
put it
we'll
on,
see.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. Let's go to David. David, what do you want to brag about, David?
Hey, thank you for having me. I had a couple questions. One, it was like a G.I. Joe. I still have it. It was a G.I. Joe. Like a fort or a house that opened up, and on the top there was a light that like a chair for one person or one figurine to sit in, and a light. I don't have the light anymore, but I have the the box, and it had like a little box with maps in it and stuff
was
like that.
Can I ask? I'll take this one. was it 80s G.I. Joe stuff? So was it for the G.I. Joe crew or for a Cobra?
I don't know. I'm 56. Yeah. It was my toy when I was little. So probably 70s or, you know, for the full-size doll, the G.I. Joe with hair and the Kung Fu grip.
All right, so that's more of the 60s variety. That's your, that's Greg, that's you.
All right, man, thanks, I'll take it. Again, the more smaller pieces you have, the better the value. You're in the wheelhouse as far as the right decade. So 60s, 70s are like gold G.I. Joe right now. So you got the right era.
There you go. All right. Thanks a lot.
How much would you think that would be worth? I would say do an
auction starting at maybe $150 and see how it goes from there.
Okay. Then one more thing is I have, I think they were Johnny West. Again, my toys growing up.
Okay.
It was like, I don't know, it was like a foot action figure, Western. He had all like a tan outfit on. And then there was like a little boy, too, with it. And then there was like the bad guy. He had a goatee and he's in all black suit.
Okay.
And then it was a guy.
Yeah, I think those were made by Marks, Lewis Marks Company. And, again, a lot of small pieces. So the more pieces and more complete, the higher the price. I think just for the figure, you're probably in the $100 range to start.
All right, there you go.
Each figure or all four together?
Probably. I would do each figure, $100 start.
All right, there you go.
Separately, yeah.
Thanks, David. 312-981-7200. The phones are lit up for Greg Flam's final show here. He is moving to Henderson, Nevada. So this is our final swap meet tonight. 312-981-7200 if you want to wish him adieu. And also at the same time, have him evaluate. see what... So,
or tell us your favorite memory of swap.
My favorite has been tonight they're getting him in. Meaning they get the one in, then they go, you know what? Well,
yeah.
Before I go, I got another
two first. Yeah.
I want to get it in before Greg's gone.
All right.
312-981-7200. Swap meet.
It's time for swap meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for swap meet with Justin Kaufman.
Hey, Greg Flam. That's right.
Now I remember it. You were explaining it. I couldn't remember.
This was the old theme song that we stopped doing after we moved to the mornings. But it's Pete Zimmerman found it, and here it is. That was the great Jason Skaggs who did the production on that. That's the best. Listen to that track. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet here. It is the final swap meet as Greg Flam is moving to Henderson, Nevada. Many on the text line are saying, hey, you know what? With phones and technology, we keep doing this.
Yeah,
you're always welcome back, and of course we will continue whenever Greg is available. But tonight, the last swap meet before he moves out of town. So let's get to some of these texts. I got tons of texts, but I also got a ton of people on the phone. So let's get to the phones first. Let's go to Barbara, who's been standing by. Barbara, what do you want to brag about, Barbara?
Hi, I have a question about an old Montgomery Ward catalog.
Nice. What year was it?
It was a... Pardon me?
What year was it?
I think it's about 1988.
Very nice. Yeah, it's a good era.
It was
strong
one of the
year.
Small home furnishing catalogs.
Okay.
And I kept it... The reason I kept it is because in one of the pictures of a set of bedding for a bed, in the background on the wall, it's kind of a faded X-rated word.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's worth anything or if I should just, you know, I just kept it because it was so odd.
Yeah. Faded X-rated words are always worth something.
Yeah, you know, what was it, the Cal Ripken's brother with the baseball bat?
On the knuckle of the bat, he had a swear word on it.
That, if it's just furniture, I'm not so sure, especially for 88. But if you had, like, the toy section for that year, now that's a different story. And if you had any of the 1960s or 70s, any of the Christmas catalogs, some of those go for about $100. Mm-hmm. And I sold the Ward's one many times for $75, $80 in not so good condition. So
yeah,
that gives
you an idea. Yeah, this is just a little one of comes through the mail like a little home furnishing catalog.
Yeah,
it's about maybe 100 pages, if that.
Yeah, I don't think it's it. Could, I don't know. I would say $20 yeah. auction to start.
All right. Thanks, Barbara. All right, let's move on to Kathy. Kathy, welcome to the swap meet. What do you want to brag about?
Hi, I was at the Cal Stanford game in the 80s, 82,
yeah, with
I think.
The band, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the band coming on the field.
That's great.
And we had season's tickets. And so then in the fall, Cal was selling T-shirts that had, the five lateral passes and then the band coming on the field
right.
with little notes. And one of the notes was laying over.
Okay.
That's my favorite part about that play, which is so iconic, is right at the end. One of the band guys just gets it, right? One, I think it's like the trombone player just gets hit so hard.
They plowed right through him.
Yep. And, I don't find that exact shirt, but an 82 Stanford Cal shirt has sold for $250 before. Yeah, so I would think that one would be maybe worth a little bit more. So I would definitely start an auction at $250, start an auction, and hopefully you'll get more than that.
Yeah.
But I do see some other Stanford Cal shirts from 1982 that have sold for that amount.
All right, there you go, Kathy.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Good luck.
And I've never liked John Elway after that.
All right.
He was such a crybaby. However, Ron Rivera was awesome.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Thanks, Kathy. All right, let's keep going. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Sue. Sue, welcome to Swap Me. What do you want to brag about?
Hi, Justin. Hi, Brett.
Hey there.
Okay, so I have a set of four Beatles dolls, John, Paul, Ringo, George.
Awesome.
They're porcelain. They're dressed in the exact, exactly just like the Sergeant Pepper costumes that they wore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say they're probably about 12 or 18 inches tall. They're in the box. I've never taken them out. They're pristine. They're just exactly the way I bought them. And I was wondering if you might have an idea.
Sure.
I don't remember the company that I bought them from.
All right. I think Greg's got it.
So first question, are the boxes pink with like just their head in the lower right-hand corner of the box?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. That rules it out.
This is like how to be a millionaire or who wants to be a millionaire, and you get the first question. You're like,
okay.
No.
Were they all in the same box now?
Yes.
Okay, I found that one.
All
and
right.
Okay. You're probably in the $400 range, and definitely do an auction because, they're harder to come by now. So, you'd have to see how many are available. I don't have that in front of me, but they have sold for about $400 to $500.
There you go. All right. How about that, Sue?
Oh, very cool.
There you go.
Okay, you will be missed. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. There you go. How about that? All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Bob, who's standing by. Bob, what do you want to brag about?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
All right, good. I think it was 99 when Ho-Ho Cam Park in Arizona had opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the gift shop over there, and they had, I think I paid around $100 or maybe more than $100 for this bobblehead of Harry Carey. And it was made out of like porcelain like type clay material that was painted with his large glasses. And it's a very good quality piece. When you say bobblehead, you think of like a cheap plastic thing, but this is actually, it has some weight to it, and it's a really nice piece. I was wondering maybe
it's
you knew.
Harry Carey, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And is it about 10 inches tall, would you say?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a few of them on eBay, and they, unfortunately, they'll go from anywhere from $40 to $90.
Oh, okay.
But
less than what I paid for it?
Yeah, unfortunately, it probably because there's just supply and demand. There's so many out there, so it's just
there is. I didn't think that they made so many.
Yeah, but I would shoot high. I started at maybe 89 and do an auction. Hopefully, you'll get.
Oh no, I would never
keep it,
think of.
Yeah, of course.
Keeping it unless I was going to get some kind of.
It's Harry Carey. Keep it.
Right.
Yeah, there
course,
you go.
Of all course.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Does Harry Carey stuff go for money?
I have never heard of it going for crazy money. But yeah, $100, $200 here and there for certain items.
Okay, let's keep going. Let's do Don. Don, welcome to the swap meet. What you want to brag about, Don?
Hey, I got a couple things from 1893 Chicago Columbian Exposition.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I got something from the 62. So the Columbian Exposition, I've got an intact ticket, meaning not torn. And then I've also got a walking stick that has a metal seal on the top of it that says Columbian Exposition 2. Nice.
So the big thing is the ticket, right? The big thing is the ticket, not ripped.
Right.
Yeah, right. It is folded, but it's not ripped.
Yeah.
There's a precinct.
Tickets seem to be going for $20 to like $70, you know, depending on condition. A lot of two recently sold for $45. If that gives you any idea.
All right.
The stick I could not find.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Thanks for that. Sorry that it wasn't more.
Yep. Thanks.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. Many people saying, "Oh, so at the beginning, this is good." 219 says, "At the beginning of the swap meet, Greg was so quiet, so reserved." And he has blossomed over the years. This is Greg's last swap meet tonight before he moves to Henderson, Nevada. Good luck to you, Greg. They said this is a huge. It's hard to lose Greg, but this person is volunteering their services.
Okay,
so there's a lot of people that are doing that.
Well, I can vet some people for you if you want.
There you go.
Continue.
630 says I have a Justin Kaufman action figure from his softball championship year.
Oh, yeah.
Which one?
Yeah, right.
You know, I've got a couple. I mean,
right, the championship one, Hall of Fame one. Which one?
You've got. I mean, there's three different championships, so right. You know, I don't know which one you're talking about. That could. They all go for different prices. They all mean something different. All right, back to.
I think your fantasy league one is worth the most, though.
Got a couple. Which one? There's a lot of those too. I'm a winner. What can you say? Let's go to Sue. Sue, what do you want to brag about? Welcome to Swap Meet. You there, Sue? She's
Hello?
Running to the phone. I can tell. You there, Sue? She's gone. All right. 312-981-7200. Mary Lou. Mary Lou's on the swap meet with Greg Flam. What do you want to brag about, Mary Lou?
Hi. My late brother-in-law was in World War II in Belgium, and he brought back my understanding is it came from a German officer. It's a copy of Mein Kampf in German. And just inside the cover, he wrote his name, Major Joseph F. I won't give you the last name. And then under that, he has Hatton, Germany, 1944.
Very nice.
And then down in the bottom right-hand corner, unfortunately, there's a water stain there, but I can read Carl Schwind is the name, and then there's LOHR, and I can't read the rest of it.
Sure.
And then a name of a town, I can give you part of it, but some of it's missing because of the water stain.
That's like a mystery.
definitely a good item. I wouldn't worry too much about the water stain.
Okay.
I know some of the copies, later copies, had swastika on it. You cannot sell that on eBay or cover up that on the, on your listing.
This
World War II.
There is a swastika on the cover. It's a round circle with a swastika in the center and an eagle type bird on the standing on the top of it.
Yeah, I've seen similar like 1942
book, and it's he brought it back from Germany and gave it to my husband eventually.
No, that's
thanks,
a great
Mary
item.
Lou. Appreciate that. But yeah, you're right. We've had this on the swap meet. I mean, I've learned this that the Nazi paraphernalia is off limits.
Yeah.
Even though it's an amazing story to get that off a German officer, and obviously it's not being used for any sort of Nazi-like
if she
nostalgia.
If she covered that up and listed it, you probably would get about $155 to $250 and definitely do an auction. You might get more. But yeah, that condition, considering how old and where, you know, you can prove where it's from, I think you'd do pretty well with that.
Yeah, I think it's cool, right? I don't think the Nazi part's cool, but the idea that the soldier got that off a German officer.
Yeah, and brought it back, yeah.
All right, let's go to Pat. Pat's standing by. Hi, Pat. Welcome to Swap Meet. Turn down your radio if you can. What do you want to brag about?
I've got a 1982 program from Diana Ross concert.
Okay.
Was it a good concert?
Excuse me?
Was it a good concert?
Yes, it certainly was.
Okay, trying to get a price for you.
I feel like a Diana Ross concert would be a jam. Like, you'd have to wear roller skates, though. Like, did you wear roller skates, Pat?
Yeah, right, you're probably in the $15 to $25 range. You know, there are quite a few. There's a lot of different years as well. I think you mentioned 1982.
1982, yeah.
Yeah, I see a couple 1982 here starting at $15. So,
well, I'd keep it. I'd keep it, Pat. Yeah. Thanks for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We'll keep going here. 312-981-7200. Tons of people calling in to get Greg's ear on his final swap meet tonight. He's moving out of town, which is a bummer for us. Mm-hmm. We've been doing this segment for 4 years. Greg has been a big part of what we do here at WGN at night, and it's awesome to spend one last Wednesday with him before he leaves for Henderson, Nevada. Roberta's up next. Roberta, what do you want to brag about, Roberta?
I have two vinyl 45-inch records of the Cubs of Jody Davis, Rick Sutcliffe, and Gary Matthews singing Go Cubs Go by Steve Goodman.
Yeah, right. Nice.
I wonder if they're worth anything.
I've had vinyl. That vinyl in, but not that version, but the Goodman one alone I've had in. I'm trying to find it, and it looks like probably about $19.99 do an auction, because they are becoming a little bit more rare. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay.
And depending on condition, are they scratched?
Oh yeah,
or not?
They're perfect.
Awesome.
Thanks, Roberta.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Well, there's a lot of reverb tonight. 312-981-7200. The phone number. We'll take a break here. I heard Jody Davis. Remember when Harry Carey said Jody? Jody yep. Davis. Yeah. Is that worth anything? Just that memory.
Well, I do remember greatest hits of swap meet, a Jody Davis button time. So that was cool.
Jody Davis button. I would totally take that. That's so great. Nothing beats the Jane Byrne coloring book, which is amazing. Well, this is amazing.
It's yours now.
The lines are lit up for the final. We'll take our break here. So the final segment of the swap meet coming up next here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Greg Flamm is here. It is the swap meet. You can find him at DuPage Picker on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Instagram. Greg is it's his final swap meet tonight, as he has he's chosen to leave the state and move to Henderson, Nevada. The moving date is coming up in the next week, and this will be his last show on Wednesday. It's been 4 years of doing this together, and I'm going to miss it, man. It's so great to have you here. You bring so much to the WGN listeners.
It's been awesome.
And to me personally, so I love it.
I can't thank you guys enough, and if I could quickly thank everyone at WGN, Bob Coyne, you guys, Pete Zimmerman, awesome, always goes the extra mile, and the listeners, of course. But a big thanks, too, to Don Wolf with Wolf's Flea Market. I mean, he sponsored the show for most of its existence.
That's right.
And the flea market opens April 5th at Rosemont.
There you go. 217 says, I'm wearing my Mayor Burns Summertime Chicago t-shirt right now.
I miss those days. Those Chicago Fest days at Navy Pier, those were the best.
Let's go to John to kick off the last part here. John, what do you want to brag about on the swap meet?
I got a Jarts lawn dart game with the box. And interestingly, when I look on eBay, it always says box only. I don't know if that's coded because you're not allowed to sell them anymore.
Yeah, that's how people have been getting around it, by selling what is an empty box. But, of course, when you buy it, they include the Jarts. But to get around eBay's...
Because they're illegal.
Yeah, they are illegal. And it's hard to believe that was a toy back then. you know, something that can impale you. But
how much do Jarts go for?
They do go for like $50 to $100, you know.
Okay, there you go.
All right, great.
Yeah, good luck.
All right, let's go to Anthony. Anthony, what do you want to brag about, Anthony?
Yes, I have a Seabrook 100 jukebox made in 1950.
Very nice.
Wow.
It's workable. It's the first jukebox that played 45s.
Okay.
And I have 50 45s in the jukebox.
Nice.
And I'm wondering what it could be worth, or that I could brag about. It's a great piece.
It's an awesome brag.
So it still works?
Yeah. Yes, it works. Very great. Nice. It plays great. It's very workable. It's a great piece.
Anthony, what's the go-to track on there for you when you're like, you know what? Let's go with B7. What's the track you like to listen to on that?
Well, there's a lot of 45s in the jukebox. There's a lot of them. But it's a great piece. It was made in 1950. It's a Seabrook 100.
Yep. Yeah. You. anywhere from $800 to $2,000, maybe a little bit over $2,000, depending on condition. You said it works, but you know, whoever's going to buy is, of course, going to test it out, make sure. The bigger thing is just delivering it. A lot of times, you just got to do local pickup on that. But yeah, that's cool. A great brand, for sure, Seabird.
It's a great piece. I've had it for 35 years. My father had it for about 40 years.
That's awesome.
I love it. I love it. Keep it. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yep.
I like that one. Get some of these hipster bar to come down there and get it from Anthony. Be like, we only play stuff from the 50s, man.
There's a repair shop by the Lyle train station, I know, that sells and repairs jukeboxes there. So Naperville, Lyle area.
Okay, let's go to Norm. Norm, welcome to the Swap Meet. What do you want to brag about?
Well, I have a very interesting piece. There was a show called The Kraft Television Theater that was very popular in the mid-50s on TV. And I have the original, I repeat, original cameraman that was used as a prop in that commercial.
Oh,
a good
nice.
Friend of mine who did the commercials willed it to me when he passed on.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's a one only in the world, and it's in absolutely excellent condition. It's made out of wood.
Wow.
It's a little cameraman on his dolly, and they actually magnetically drew it across in front of the camera.
That's awesome.
And so it's a one only piece.
That's great. I couldn't even put a price on that, but that is such an awesome, piece to have. And
yeah, right.
Keep
wouldn't that
passing
be great?
Down.
That's amazing. All right. Awesome. Thanks for the story, Norm. Appreciate it. 312-981-7200. We're getting close to the end of the last swap meet here. For the swap meet, I have a vinyl banner from the original release of The Little Mermaid, used to promote the movie in the movie theater. It appears to not have been hung, as the Velcro on the back is still intact.
Very nice.
Well, those are like in the lobby.
Yeah, probably.
Do those go for a lot of money?
Yeah, movie posters, movie banners, any kind of promotional. It's all obviously about which movie it was. But
right.
Little Mermaid, Disney obviously does well. So I'd say, start in the 300 range and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Auction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 312-981-7200. Going through these texts that are all about missing you. I have a Betsy McCall doll, says 224. She still has two barrettes in her hair, and her crotch is not cracked. I don't know what that's referring to, but
okay. I've seen them go for $250 to $300. So, and you got the barrettes, so the only thing better would be in the box. So,
okay, there you go. Let's go to Rose. Rose, what do you want to brag about on the swap meet?
I have two slot machines, Greg.
Oh,
they're both Mills slot machines. One is a 10 cent slot machine. It's the Castle slot machine.
Okay.
And the circa year is about 1946.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
The other slot machine is also a Mills, and the circa on that is like 1937, and it's a 5 cent slot machine, and it's called a diamond slot machine.
That's awesome.
What would
diamond
you think
slot
on?
Machine. I like that.
Yeah. It's because it has diamonds, like 4 or 5 diamonds on the face of the machine. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
what do you think?
That's incredible.
They were my mom and dad's, and when my dad passed away, of course, my mom had them, and then when she passed away, she gave them to me.
Yeah, they're
and
going
I
for
know,
more than $3,000. So, I mean, that's just awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
A piece? $3,000
a
piece?
Yeah, $3,000 a piece.
Wow.
I would definitely have them checked out, see if it's worth maybe putting a few hundred into it if it's not working, and get it working because you'll get more
work.
Money. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, they both work, and they both have stands also.
Oh, that you're definitely then upwards of even 4,000 or more then.
Wow. How about
that?
Yeah, that's great.
Wow,
there
that's
you go,
amazing.
Rose. That's awesome.
I know that I know you can't sell them to certain states. I've researched it.
Mm-hmm.
And that the federal law says, like Indiana and a couple of, I think there's like 8 states that you cannot sell them to. People who live in those states.
Well, that gives you 42 states to work with.
I still think if you were to do it on eBay, I think you still could get, you still could ship those somehow, and I think you'd be all right.
Okay. Well, thank you
no
so
problem.
Very
luck,
much.
Rose.
And good luck to you in
thank
your new
you.
Home.
Thank you.
There you go. Thanks, Rose. That's a nice gesture.
Yep. Awesome.
That's interesting, because I would say she waits a year, or the other 8 states will probably also follow suit.
Yeah, and I'm looking at eBay, and if they're selling that much, I can't see crossing states with that being a problem as far as shipping it.
Well, Greg, we're out of time, and as I said this entire hour, that it's been really great remembering and recalling some of the memories from this segment. It's been 4 years we've been doing it together, and as we told you, you know, Greg is moving to Henderson, Nevada, coming up right here in March. And so this will be his last swap meet. And like I said, we'll do some more. You'll come back to town, visit
family. Come out through the summer, right?
Yeah, you come through and we'll get you back on air. And if we have any questions about slot machines or...
give me a call.
porcelains or ceramics of any kind, we'll give you a call.
I could stop by Orion's place and get the T1 connection
go.
Going.
Right, exactly. It's all WGN family.
Right.
Greg Flamm can be found at DuPage Picker on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and on YouTube. He, of course, continues to be a picker when he goes out to Henderson. Actually, probably a better location for it anyway with all the...
Yeah, it's definitely different, but they do have more thrift stores in a smaller area, so that helps. And they'll still have estate sales, everything, so nothing's really going to change.
You know? And they don't know out there that you go to the toy box first, dig as deep as you can, and you get all the pieces.
We do probably hit out there tonight, but I don't think... Hopefully no one heard that.
Across the paint. Right.
It'll be fun.
Greg Flamm, of course, two-page picker and a longtime part of the WGN family, at least 4 years here. Greg, thanks so much.
No problem.
Good luck in Henderson.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you, listeners.